WRAF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Wow. What do you think, Jolene?
Brand new stuff. I feel like I made the grade. My name is on the show.
Mike is absolute. Tell the story.
Mike Agliano, who's production director here at WRIF, he put together this at the last minute tonight because he wanted to just get us something because we talked to him about doing some production for us,
right.
A new intro, because Peter accidentally blew out everything, the old stuff,
yeah.
Which was, I think, meant to be. Yeah, yeah. So he just came in here. I mean, 3 seconds before that played and got it up there. He's so good, Mike Agliano.
I said, Mike, it's 7 seconds to showtime.
He did it. The guy's amazing. You can tell he's been under the gun a lot, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you, Mike.
You want to hear it one more time?
Are you excited?
Yeah. Yeah, we can do it.
Because it sounds so good.
Yeah, it does. It's absolutely incredible.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Our new music, get used to it.
The theme.
Yeah.
From Peter Gunn. Yeah, it was
right on.
1960s.
So good we had to play it twice there.
Yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, Mike, you're incredible. Well, absolutely.
Yeah,
incredible.
He's not in the top 10 market for nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, hey, folks, although you just got the phone number, we'll give it to you again. We'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And if you're listening for the first time, we're giving you phone numbers because this is a phone-in talk show. Jolene and I give our opinions, as Mike said, and we'd like to hear yours. Call TalkYes at Yahoo.com is our email address. Call TalkYes at Yahoo. And that means when the lines are filled, which they are not now, or if you're bashful, you can send us email messages. If they're long, I'll probably read them tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, I just answered somebody. You ready for this? May 2008.
But you did?
Yeah.
Like a year and a half ago,
yeah,
as in.
Yeah.
Really?
So
what, did it take you that long to form an opinion, or...
I had it down to about 250, and I said, I gotta get this email stuff down. I don't answer every single person, but if there's something to answer.
Right. True. Some people just want to give you information or
state an opinion. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. Although, no jokes, please. No.
Well, you haven't said that in a long time.
Yes. Do not send me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Everything you send to everyone.
Yeah, right.
You know, maybe some of this is finally fading, because I used to get, there was a guy, he'd send me something at 8 a.m., then 11 p.m., then 11 a.m., early in the morning, then like 11 a.m., then like 1:30 p.m., then like 4:30 p.m., then 8 p.m., and I'm thinking, I finally wrote, but maybe that's why, because I insulted him. I said, you need to get outside.
Well, because it was a beautiful day in Detroit.
Yeah. Yeah. But, for all I know, maybe he was, that you or me?
No, Peter. It's always you.
Always me, right. Feedback there. All right, listen, what a week this has been, both tragedy and interesting stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, this is the kind of week I think, we got to have a daily talk show again, but too much work.
But it's worth it because we're doing a service.
Hey, one of our favorite bands is called The Layabouts, right?
Right, that's true.
Yeah. So
yeah, well, you've taught me well, Peter.
Yes. Actually, somebody who's never really sitting still, had the pleasure of meeting yesterday, is, why do I keep...
Danny Glover.
Danny Glover, yeah.
The actor.
The actor.
And activist. He's and big activist. Time, yeah.
He is. And he visited a home and project office called the Hush House. It's in Detroit. It's the poorest neighborhood in Detroit. There are half the homes there do not have electricity or water or heating. Yeah. And so one of the two people that run it, Charles and Sandra Simmons, she said to Danny Glover, she said, this isn't like a third world country. This is a third world country here because you have that lack of facilities that we take for granted. And the Simmons are doing such incredible work down there, mentoring people, helping people that have come out of jail, because we know the statistics about young black men in prison and the judicial system and all of that. And he was just so interested in everything they were doing. He was here in town doing a movie, it took time to go to this, this the poor neighborhood in this home that Charles Simmons' grandparents had bought decades and decades ago. And you could almost measure what was happening in Detroit, for it was once a prosperous black neighborhood, say in the 40s and all that, where jobs were to be had. And now it's, except for this little oasis where Charles and some of the adjoining homes have said, we're going to take a stand right here. We're going to make
something
of our lives. And the manner in which they talked about wanting a world of cooperation and love and what have you is just extraordinary.
Danny Glover was just there observing?
He spoke a little, and he is such an eloquent guy. It's easy if you got a script in front of you, but he didn't, and yet still. So, a friend of mine was driving him around, and he had, these guys. So he was there for about an hour, as was I. And so I said, come on, let's get Danny Glover on, for an interview.
On Night Call.
Night Call, absolutely. So we're going to do that.
Work that out. Great.
Okay. I'll turn my headphones down.
I know.
Richard Hayes, who used to be, who was our tech guy for computers here at WRIF, and he used to be a DJ on old WXYZ AM, a top 40 DJ back in the late 50s and early 60s, who now wears a hearing aid. He said, man, if you're a DJ, you're going to lose your hearing.
Yeah, you're going to have some problems.
What? Oh, I heard you.
DJs, jeez. But you know who's worse? Musicians?
Yeah, sure.
Drummers? I hear better than all of them. Because I live with a couple of musicians, and I'm the only one who hears half of the things that go on.
Well, one of the things we said is that we weren't going to spend a lot of time talking about right-wingers and how goofy they are. But
goofy, you're being nice.
Yeah. And what psychos
they are. We're talking about the rabid right-wingers, sure.
Yeah, one of them was Carrie Prejean. Remember her? She was not Miss USA. She said that she got bumped off of there because she had the wrong opinion on gay marriage.
Yeah.
And it's not even clear that that's what it was. Miss North Carolina won. She might have won regardless. Anyways, there was all these suits and countersuits.
Well, that's how much she loves herself. Yeah. Of course, she should have won.
Donald Trump owns Miss USA. Not.
And Donald Trump bought her boobs.
Yeah, she had a boob job.
Yeah.
And so then it came out, and then she became Miss Christian Values.
Oh yeah.
And she was like 15 minutes of fame in the conservative pantheon of nobodies with Joe the Plumber.
Right.
Who else was? I can't remember. They come and go so fast. And some media people
and Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin, right? Whose book has not even been published, but is a bestseller. With pre-orders, yeah. But she had demanded, she being Carrie Prejean, not Sarah Palin, she had demanded more than $1 million during her settlement negotiations with Miss California USA pageant officials. That is, until the pageant showed Carrie and a XXX home video of her handiwork.
Of Carrie Prejean's work.
A sex tape.
Yes.
Of Miss Christian Values.
Another sex tape. Oh, my gosh.
To a double feature. What's that woman? What's her name? Oh, Paris Hilton.
Oh, yeah. There's Paris and Kim Kardashian.
But Paris Hilton, I read a thing saying more people have seen her having sexual intercourse than any woman in the history of the world.
No kidding. Even Pam Anderson?
Oh, maybe it was Pam. No. Right.
Yeah, because a lot of us have seen, they've both done it, you know. I mean, I used to own the Tommy Lee, Pamela Anderson one. I lost it in the divorce.
He took it.
Of course he did.
Well, it only makes sense.
Well, he fell, let's not go there.
So here's what's happening.
He got to know it well.
The video the lawyer showed Carrie Prejean is extremely graphic and has never been released publicly. We know that, and this is TMZ. You can go to TMZ.com. We know that because TMZ obtained the video months ago but decided not to post it because it was so racy. Let's just say Carrie has a promising solo career.
I love this. Peter, the minute I saw it, I said, must send immediately.
We're told it took about 15 seconds for Carrie to jettison her demand and essentially walk away with nothing. As we first reported, the pageant is paying about $100,000 to her lawyers and publicists, a fraction of her bills. She pockets nothing in the settlement, and the Miss California had sued her, wanting the $5,000 back they paid for her boob job. Now, apparently, according to TMZ, for the 8th, that's today, Carrie Prejean wasn't the only member of her family who got a peek at Carrie's solo sex tape. TMZ has learned her mom was in the room.
That's so bad.
Miss California USA lawyers pressed play. Sources tell TMZ Carrie's mom was in shock, instantly turning sheet white as she watched her daughter give herself a hand.
This juicy stuff. And you know what? I'm sure there are some people very disappointed in us right now, because look at all this stuff. If they could see all of the news stories we have in front of us, and this is the one we start with.
Well, I mean,
we apologize, kind of, but there's a point to this, Peter.
There is, that these people are such hypocrites. They're liars. And here's the thing. Democrats have, and liberals and radicals and progressives and leftists have a real high sense of integrity and a desire for honesty and all. That doesn't mean that they never fall off the edge or don't do anything crooked, particularly Democrats. But independent leftists and liberals and the like, they say, look, we were really glad to get Barack Obama in office. It was so meaningful. The guy is so eloquent. He spoke to everything that had gone wrong in this country, and particularly everything that had gone wrong for the preceding 8 years, and worked like crazy. Well, now that they've seen Barack Obama in office, and he's just a mainstream politician, as opposed to the far right-wing nut job that Bush was, all the crazy psycho right-wingers he had in government. So, I mean, it is an improvement, to be sure, but nothing like people thought it was going to be. I mean, when somebody says change, we thought there was going to be massive change, and that hasn't happened. So, and we'll get to that. We'll talk about the elections. So the Democrats, the people that would vote Democratic, just peeled off, and they stayed at home with some of these elections, like in Virginia and in New Jersey. Whereas no matter how many exposés, if you can, of all these self-righteous Republicans, you know, who you know, are having extramarital affairs and, you know, and doing little boys and, you know, they're voting against gays and they're gay themselves and they're corrupt and, you know, this Carrie Prejean is, you know, doing this.
Ted Haggard.
Remember him? Yeah. I mean, this does not. I mean, they are like these conservatives, these right wingers are like dogs on bones. I don't care. I mean, they just go, you know, they are just so rabid. I mean, that's the problem. And that's what's frightening. You know, I'm going to do something else that I haven't.
Yeah, there's a lot of frothing at the mouth going on for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's I don't know, you know, what's in order of importance. Maybe so. Maybe it's the medical thing. That just got passed
by the economy, the health care.
Here's something from Detroit. They'll give you an idea of what people are facing. And, you know, if you have a good health plan like I do, maybe you say, who cares? You know, so then you're low on the compassion scale, and you don't have the qualities that mark human beings. And, you know, there's a book by, what the hell is his name? I can't remember. Philip K. Dick, who wrote the story for Blade Runner, for instance.
Oh yeah,
what he called it.
I finally saw that.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm a little
Well, the book is incredible. It's called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of them. Arnold Schwarzenegger did a lot of his books. You know, Arnold always appeared in these left-wing films, never understood the messages, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is from the Detroit Free Press today. Alberto Paredes was hailed as a hero in the summer after saving the life of a choking woman at the restaurant where he works bussing tables. Now the community is being asked to help his family as they struggle to pay bills that have multiplied since his wife, Marcela, 35, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in March. Alberto's employer, the Breakfast Club in Farmington Hills, is holding a fundraiser Saturday. Let me see. It's coming up. That's good. I thought it was over. The family's debt is mounting, and Marcela can't work. Alberto works two jobs but can't make ends meet. He doesn't have health insurance.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice of the owner of the Breakfast Club to help him. It would have helped a lot more if she would have given him an insurance plan, right?
Yeah.
Jill Scarborough, who owns the eatery, says it's the compassionate thing to do. You can't do something to help everybody, but we should all try to help each other if we can, which is good sentiment and does show compassion. You know, no one even knows why I brought up Blade Runner, do you?
Yeah, but what was that?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Where?
Here's one. In it, the androids were identical to human beings. You couldn't tell them apart.
I remember that.
And I read it so long ago and saw it so long ago, I can't exactly remember what they were, but in fact, they weren't called androids. They were called replicants.
Okay, that's right.
And the only way you could tell the replicants from the human beings was through, they would look into their eyes with this little scope, and they had no capacity to empathize.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So Philip K. Dick, who was quite a science fiction writer and quite radical, he marked a definition of a human being as someone with compassion. Somebody with empathy.
I see what you're saying.
If you can't empathize with other people, you've lost a human quality.
They don't qualify anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, that's why I was reading this. If you can't empathize with people like this, I don't know what to say. Her cancer, this sounds bad, is in her liver and her bones now. She's completing, this is the wife. But any event, whether Jill Scarborough, the owner of the Breakfast Club in Farmington Hills, just figured it would be less money for her if she paid for health care for her employees, or as is the case with some small business owners, can't afford it because of the extraordinary cost of it.
Right.
And it's rising for small businesses. You think she would be way on board with
health care reform.
Yeah, yeah. I guess this is more stuff. Lack of paid sick days may worsen flu pandemic. Public health experts worried about the spread of the H1N1 flu are raising concerns that workers who deal with the public, like waiters and childcare employees, are jeopardizing others by reporting to work sick because they do not get paid for days they miss for illness. Now, this is unheard of in other capitalist countries, in Europe and Canada and what have you.
It's also appalling to these people in other countries.
Yeah. Yeah. Tens of millions of people, or about 40% of all private sector workers, do not receive paid sick days, and as a result, many of them cannot afford to stay home when they are ill. Even some companies that provide paid sick days have policies that make it difficult to call in sick, like giving demerits each time someone misses a pay. I know this is going to shock you people, but Walmart's.
Oh.
Walmart is one of them. Yeah. Health experts say policies like these encourage many people with the swine flu to report to work despite official warnings. Said Robert Blendon, a professor of health policy at Harvard, for people who are really caught on a weekly income, if they can't make a go of it, they might say, I'm desperate. I'm going to do what I have to do. I'm going to work even though I'm sick.
I know.
He warned that this might spread disease and that these financially squeezed workers might send their flu-stricken children to school because they've got to still go to work, infecting others. So, I mean, doesn't this suggest the need for an immediate, universal, single-payer health care? I don't get the... and then this goes on quite a bit. Workers in many retailers and restaurants say employers' policies discourage them from calling in sick. At Walmart, when employees miss one or more days because of illness or other reasons, they generally get a demerit point. Once employees obtain 4 points over a six-month period, they begin to receive warnings that can lead to dismissal. These son of bitches.
Yes.
At Walmart. These people.
It's evil.
The five owners of Walmart, the Walton family heirs, the total of them have more money than Bill Gates. I mean, so they got, like, I forgot what it is, maybe like $60 billion in wealth.
Loads of money.
And so, if you, you know, you're going to get a demerit.
Yeah, you know, and I don't care how... How poor I ever have been or will be or whatever. I will not go there.
Yeah. Then it talks about this one guy who he went to work at Walmart, but then his supervisor sent him home because he looked pale, adding that he did not see a doctor because he could not afford the company's health insurance. I mean, Walmart, every time I mention Walmart, I say this. They could afford to pay everybody $20 an hour, give everybody the best health care with no deductibles, and they'd still be worth billions.
That's right.
So it's psychopathology.
And a big dose of greed.
Yeah, well, it's
greed that's led to psychopathology.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to be greedy. I mean, you know, we're tantalized with all these commodities that we could get, and if you've got tens of thousands, you think get more tens of thousands. You say, "Whoa, I could get a Buick instead of Chevy, and I could get a, you know, a $4,000 watch instead of a, you know, $200 watch," and all. And then if you start getting millions, you start thinking, "Oh, I could get a home here."
Well, it's so true. It does happen.
Yeah, and but after a while, there's nothing left to consume. There's nothing that the Waltons can buy. It's just this huge amount of impacted wealth that they use to screw their employers. Excuse me.
Employees.
Yeah. The survey found that 11% of respondents said they had lost a job for taking off or an illness for themselves or a family member. 13% said they had been told they'd be fired or suspended if they missed work because of personal or family industry.
That's depressing.
All right. One more thing about health care. Hey, anybody like to comment on the elections, on what happened at the Fort Hood? Any of you had, I don't know if this would give you any special insight, but any of you had been stationed at Fort Hood and what you thought? I mean, I don't know. What can you say? Nicholas Kristof says in this column from November 5th in the New York Times on Healthy America, the moment of truth for health care is at hand. He was talking about the vote coming up that passed the House bill for health care reform, so-called. We'll get to that in a second. But he says the distortion that perhaps gets that gets the most traction is this. And I've heard it from some of you. He says, this is the myth. We have the greatest healthcare system in the world. Sure, it has its flaws, but it saves lives in ways that other countries can only dream of. Abroad, people sit on waiting lists for months, so why should we squander billions of dollars to mess with a system that is the envy of the world? As Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama puts it, President Obama's plans amount to the first step in destroying the best healthcare system the world has ever known. That's
for wealthy people,
in
their opinion, which is just not even true, like you said.
Yeah. So Nicholas Kristof says that self-aggrandizing delusion may be the single greatest myth in the health care debate. The United States ranks 31st in life expectancy, tied with Kuwait and Chile. So we can say USA,
right,
USA, number 31.
Right.
And let's see, we rank 37th in infant mortality and 34th in maternal mortality. A child in the United States is 2.5 times as likely to die by age 5 as in Singapore or Sweden. And an American woman is 11 times as likely to die in childbirth as a woman in Ireland. Canadians live longer than Americans do after kidney transplants and after dialysis. One review examined 10 studies of how the American and Canadian systems dealt with various medical issues. The United States did better in 2, Canada did better in 5, and in 3 they were similar or it was difficult to determine. So, you know, somebody put down Canadian health. That's not what the studies show. Yet another study cited in a recent report by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation looked at how well 19 developed countries succeeded in avoiding preventable deaths, such as those where a disease could be cured or forestalled. What Senator Shelby of Alabama called the best health care system ranked in last place.
Yeah.
Ready for that, folks? We are dead last. The United States of America in preventable deaths. The figures are even worse for members of minority groups. An African American in New Orleans has a shorter life expectancy than an average person in Vietnam or Honduras.
Yeah, it's shameful.
Shameful is the word. Absolutely shameful. So coming out of this, there is a health care bill that is fully inadequate as far as I'm concerned. And most of the people that voted against it, the Democrats at least, or the Republicans, you know, they just... they're conservatives. They want to conserve what is. They want to conserve the domination of the healthcare industry. They want to conserve the idea that tens of millions of people are excluded from it. That's what they want to conserve.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's see. Hey, for all you conservatives, there's hope for you.
There is?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of defeating even tepid health care reform.
Right. True, true, true.
Because Associated Press says the glow from a health care triumph faded quickly for President Barack Obama on Sunday as Democrats realized the bill they fought so hard to pass in the House has nowhere to go in the Senate. Speaking from the Rose Garden, much says, you know. Carried on. The problem is that the Senate won't run with it. The government health insurance plan included in the House bill is unacceptable to a few Democratic moderates who hold the balance of power in the Senate. If a government plan is part of the deal, Joe Lieberman, that scumbag, now an independent, who they need to overcome GOP filibuster, says he'll filibuster himself. Right-wing Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said dismissively, the House bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. Democrats did not line up to challenge him. So it doesn't look real good. You know, I don't know if I want to just keep reading to you and reading to you. So part of it is about this public option that would create a health insurance entity that would compete with these bandits, these thieves, these highwaymen,
highway robbers,
of the insurance companies. And it turns out initially only about 2 or 3% of the people would even take it, but this seems to be the lodestone of opposition. But a poll released on October 20th found that most Americans support one of the most controversial health care reform options being debated. 57% of us either strongly or somewhat support having the government create a new health insurance plan to compete with private health insurance plans. Some 40% said they were strongly or opposed to the so-called public option, because I guess they don't want any competition with the private health insurance plans.
Of course not.
So they just, what do you mean, of course not? So then their stuff is going to just keep going up and up.
Right.
Yeah. And although we said that we were going to stop just bashing the right wing, for one thing, that takes up time.
Yeah, wait, what happened to that?
What? Are we going and I keep doing it? Well, this is...
We can't help ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Andrew Beecham, who came to crazy... what's her name?
Crazy?
Yeah.
Ann Coulter? Let's see.
No. I don't know why. I can't think of Bachman.
Michelle Bachman.
Yeah, yeah. So they got about 4,000 people out to this demonstration on Monday at the...
In Washington,
on the steps of the Capitol. Again, this was organized by Fox News.
Yeah.
So one of these guys, a guy named Andrew Beecham, who I actually Googled, who's worth looking at, he's... President Obama was going to Capitol Hill then, and he screamed at him, "You'll be starting a civil war, you fascist tyrant!"
Oh, my God. Who's the fascist tyrant?
Yeah. Mr. Beecham, his hair in a ponytail, said in an interview that he believed Mr. Obama was a fascist because he asserted the bill would force Americans to pay for abortions and for government-provided health care. Now, that's out of the bill.
What a nut.
Yeah, he is a nut. How can people repeat things that are demonstrably not true? That's what I don't
because
understand.
Because they're so ignorant.
It's beyond ignorant. It's psychopathology.
Well, it is psychopathology, for sure.
Yeah. Let's see. So he doesn't want government-provided health care. Reminded that Americans have long contributed to Medicare and Medicaid, he said, "I would favor getting rid of both of them. And Social Security, too."
Really?
But get this.
And he probably makes nothing.
Yeah. He doesn't have health insurance.
See? There you go.
Yeah. When I need health care, I pay for it out of pocket. Well,
yeah,
I hope you don't need
you're happy about that? What an idiot.
Yeah, I hope you don't need a liver transplant plan or something like that. He said he didn't fear the possibility that an accident or illness would leave him with unaffordable bills. I'm a Christian, so I'm not afraid of death.
Please.
Well, maybe you're not afraid of death. How about bankruptcy?
Yeah, right. How about suffering?
Yeah.
Poverty. Starving.
See. More of them. They were chanting, kill the bill, kill the bill, kill the bill.
Yeah,
the crowd was invited on national television by Representative Michelle Bachmann of Republican of Minnesota. And so they were chanting also, politicians lie, people die. Now, again, you know, they've been trying to take all these slogans from the left.
Yeah, remember I had that on my car. Bush lied, people died. I had that on my car for 2 years.
Yeah, so, but what does that mean? It makes no sense in this context.
I know. It really doesn't. That's part of the psychopathology.
Yeah. Politicians lie, people die, read one sign, but loudly cheered the House Republicans who hosted the event. The protests attract many so-called Tea Party demonstrators angry with increased spending and expanded government role under the Clinton administration. House Republican leader John Boehner of Ohio told the crowd that this bill is the greatest threat to freedom I've ever seen.
I mean, talk about putting the fear of whatever in them.
Yeah. The crowd
just the fear.
Yeah. The crowd, including many older Americans, carried placards saying, free health care isn't free. It is for them,
right.
Or almost, you know, you have to, I guess, the Section B of Medicare, you have to pay like $60 a month.
Man, yeah. That would be.
Could you handle it?
Yeah.
And also here, another guy, Ben Foreman, 72, of Farmington, New Jersey, was at this rally. He said, it's upsetting because of where we've come from to where we are today to see our freedom eroding. The retiree wore a T-shirt that said, liberty equals limited government. Well, I wonder if you told them we were going to limit the government so that you wouldn't have any Medicare or Social Security, buddy.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then the whole long list. They won't pick up your garbage. You know,
yeah, right.
You know, all of these things.
Well, here, and this is really depressing, although I don't know what to say. Conservatives continue to outnumber moderates and liberals in the American populace in 2009, confirming a finding that Gallup first noted in June. 40% of Americans describe their political views as conservative, 36% as moderate, and 20% as liberal. So they're a minority. The 56% of us say we're moderate or liberal, but 20% is liberal? I don't know what to say.
Let's know. I know what to say. I don't like polls. I don't know if I buy them.
Yeah. I don't know. It's all too, what's that song? It's all too something or other.
It's all too almost unbearable.
All right. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, we haven't even taken a call yet. We are a phone-in talk show. I'd like to hear from you what you think about the health reform bill, what you thought about the elections on Tuesday, what you thought about the shootings at Fort Hood, or anything else that's on your mind. And it's 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
We'll be right back. In fact, we're going to be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
The Strip Down Lounge is back. Your concert station, 101 WRIF and MGM Grand Detroit, have your chance to win VIP passes to an intimate acoustic performance with Wolf Woman. Performing this Thursday night at Clutch Cargos and Pontiac. Listen to 101 The Rim for your chance to see them before their show. Up close and acoustic at MGM Grand Detroit's Ignite Sushi Bar and Lounge. Plus, you'll score tickets to the show at Clutch Cargos later that night.
Visit and win.
From MGM Grand Detroit.
The ultimate entertainment experience.
At 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Ah, Thanksgiving. The food, the family, the zombie.
Wait a minute, what the hell?
101 WRIF presents the Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. Somebody's gonna wake your ass up from the food drama. The Rim has you covered. Rob Zombie Live. Friday, November 27th at the Fillmore Detroit.
Tickets available now. Get them exclusively at LiveNation.com.
Thanksgiving weekend will never be the same. The Rim. Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. The Fillmore Detroit. Friday, November 27th from your concert station. 101 WRIF. The Rim.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Jalene Jordan is with me. We're at 313-298-WRIF. Got some callers waiting. You can join us at that number, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jeff in Richmond. Jeff, welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air.
How are we doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Good. You know, I was just calling. I was listening to you guys there, and, you know, myself, my fiance, and my two children are all on Medicaid, unfortunately, at the time being. But I don't know why the government has such a problem with finding a model for government-run health care, because we already have really, ultimately, I think, not that bad of a system in the Medicaid system. You know, we're able to see whatever doctors we need and without copay most of the time.
Now, what do you think about a guy that I quoted earlier, a conservative that said he'd like to abolish Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security?
Well, I think you should come talk to my 7-year-old that has to get stitches, it seems like, every 6 months.
Right.
I'll tell you, if it weren't for that, me and my family would be in a world of hurt, I can tell you.
Well, he says that you should pay for it out of pocket.
Well, I'll tell you, I do work. I don't sit at home. I pay taxes. I pay into everything. Unfortunately, I just don't make enough to cover our bills. And with Michigan having the open enrollment, I was able to qualify. Now, my kids, as well as my fiance, have been recipients for quite some time, only because my job doesn't offer any type of health plan.
Well, you're not alone. There's a whole lot of people who are just, and I'm glad that they can help you.
Yeah.
Right. Well, as am I. You know, I went without insurance for quite some time. And, you know, I was just very fortunate that nothing happened in that time where I needed any type of health care.
Well, you know, you get this opposition. So the majority of American people want a public option. They want to be relieved of both the cost and the anxiety about paying for health care. And it's not just among people that are of lower income. I mean, middle class people are extraordinarily worried. You lose your job and suddenly you're looking at $800 a month for this COBRA program. Or, you know, if you start getting older, people that I've talked to are paying like $1,200 a month, and you know they're middle class, and so that's like $14,000 a year to pay for a health plan.
Well, yeah, and then the result is you have to cut back in other ways, and so eat food that's cheaper, that's not as fresh, and so that hurts your health as well.
Yeah. All right, Jeff, thanks for that story. So Medicaid as a model, or Medicare as a model. Now, in a little while, there was most of the Democrats that voted against the House plan. It was probably okay with the Democratic leadership because they... you know, because the bill passed anyways, and they're in districts. A great number of them were in districts that were won by John McCain in 2008, and they're very worried about reelection.
Oh, true.
Yeah.
Of course they are.
Yeah. And also, but there were a few people on the left, like Dennis Kucinich of Cleveland, who would have been nice to have been president. I mean, it was great to have Barack Obama because of, you know, it was one step forward in one important direction.
Yeah.
But the politics that were enunciated by Dennis Kucinich are so much better than Barack Obama puts out there.
Agreed.
And also, what was there, one other guy that voted against it because he thought it was just going to... I don't even know why the insurance companies are against it. They're going to have like 40 million new customers. That's what Kucinich is saying.
Right.
All right, let's take some more calls. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mitch in Clinton Township. Mitch, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it?
Good.
I'm a 20-year-old from Clinton Township, and I try to stay updated on current events going on. And I'm not really sure as to if America is overall getting better, getting out of the slump that we've been in, or it's getting worse, because it seems like Congress and the president is telling us that it's getting better, but a lot of companies around me, they're just seem to be shutting down and saying this is the worst year ever. And I just wanted your guys' opinion on what you think.
Well, I appreciate that, but I'll tell you, it's hard to call. And, you know,
we knew it was going to get way worse before it got better. And we knew it was going to be that way for a few years. But it's not Barack Obama's fault.
Yeah.
It's George W. Bush's fault.
Well, forgetting about fault, which I agree with you 100%, mm-hmm. obviously. But the stock market is now back over 10,000. All the Richie Rich kids are doing really well again. All the people that screwed themselves themselves and got bailed out and screwed all of us who didn't get bailed out. They're back riding high in the saddle. There's now up to, if you include everybody in it, 17% unemployment. And Detroit proper would love to have a unemployment rate that low. I mean, how do you measure? I would say you'd measure by, Mitch, by people around you and what's happening. I mean, it's kind of weird if you think about it. 83% of the people have jobs. You'd say, wow, hey, that's great. 83% of us have jobs.
Right.
But, I mean, during the Depression, 75% of the people had jobs. So, you have to measure it by the lower number, and it doesn't look good from that end. We're told that the job recovery lags behind the upper levels of the economy. So I guess we're just going to have to see, because right now we're just passive observers. We're hoping that the big shots, the rich guys, the powerful, the power elite, the ruling class, whatever you want to call them, aren't going to really either screw us more or screw everything up. Because there is a worst case scenario in this, and this is that there'd be what they call this sort of W-shaped, not for Bush either, but this W-shaped recession, like happened in the 1930s, is that there was all this government stimulus, all these government programs, all these people were hired, and then Roosevelt in the late 30s says, oh, okay. I mean, he listened to these people that said the government didn't have to put as much money into the economy, and it flopped again, and the only thing that brought us out of the Depression was the war economy that began with the Second World War, but now we are on a permanent war economy, and rather than bringing us out of a depression or a recession, it is one of the factors that's driven us into it. So you're asking me, what in the hell am I saying definitively? I guess I would say, so, Mitch, nothing. I don't know.
Right. But isn't the worst-case scenario turning into a third-world country, or is that way too far down the line to even look at?
Well, I don't know if you heard me earlier, and I don't remember whether I said this on the air or not, but when I visited these people that were in Detroit in trying to make the best of a pretty terrible situation and doing a pretty good job in their little neighborhood, they said it was like a third-world country there. Many of the homes without electricity or what have you, without heating, without water, a lot of water shutoffs in Detroit, and they're bringing in, I don't think I said this, did I? They're bringing in solar stoves using in Africa. For heating, yeah, because it's environmentally, because there's been, all the fuel, which you can, like, trees and all that.
If you pay less and you're using the sun, hey.
Well, it's not, and people could say, that's Detroit, what that's all about. But I don't know. Is that the rump end or the leading edge? I mean, I think that's the question that you're saying, Mitch.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right, well, thanks a lot, guys. Take more call.
Yeah.
Stay informed. Good job.
I would like to think, they used to say during the 30s, hooray, the workers are starving, the revolution will be here soon. Well, I think even if the workers are starving, I don't think the revolution is going to be here, soon.
Not the type of revolution we're talking about on this show.
No. Now, Julian, I don't want you to jump out of your chair.
Okay, I'm gonna play thank some you music. For the warning.
Yeah.
It's a doggone shame the way the big boss plays the game. It's a doggone shame the way the big boss plays the game. They work you like a mule, they treat you like a dog. It's a doggone shame.
No, we haven't flipped a country.
No, we haven't. That's from the album Solidarity Rocks, put out by the United Steelworkers. And, so the broader measure of U.S. unemployment stands at 17.5%, maybe even double that in the city of Detroit, maybe more. For all the pain caused by the Great Recession, the job market still was not in as bad shape as it has been during the depths of the early 1980s recession until now. And this is pretty interesting because because they talk about the previous recorded high was 17.1% in December 1982. And none of the Republicans are really going to look at now who was president at that time.
Mm.
Yeah. And it is Reaganomics that is, you know, the whole idea that there would be, that this economy could operate without strict regulatory controls on the greed heads that run things at the top of the economic mechanism that has brought us to this level. I mean, the Democrats often cooperated. Clinton signed some bills and what have you. Right now, a revised formula puts 1 in 6 Americans in poverty. Nothing like this exists in those. You know, we're number one. Remember people used to say that, the best country in the world, we're number one. Well, when you have almost 50 million Americans living in poverty, and millions of those are children, by the way. You can say, yeah, they just won't get a job. You know, well, I hope by now you realize
we can't get a job.
Yeah, in the 1930s, they were saying the same thing. Anybody can get a job if they really try.
Yeah, well, it's not true.
Yeah.
It is so not true.
Yeah, because again, you know, the conservatives, and remember they talk about an oxymoron or some other kind of moron, that the whole, you know, compassionate conservative doesn't exist. I mean, you know, they'll give to charities. They'll give to charities.
Oh, yeah, and it's the very wealthy women who do, you know, their juniors, junior league charity thing, and
well, it's vertical. That's what's about charity. It leaves the class structure and wealth distribution just as it was.
True.
But they figure, oh, you know, I'll give, we'll have a ball for, you know, blankets for the homeless.
I had a big, giant argument with this woman who, you know, you have no idea how much I do in the church, and I take care of my four boys, and I'm like, first of all, I don't care that you had children. You did that. Second of all, you're stinking rich. And third of all, I don't care about your religion either.
All right. Peter Werby and Jillian Jordan at 313.
She said I play dirty.
298 WRIF. Hey, we had a caller, the first caller, that said Medicare was absolutely fabulous. I think we may be getting another opinion here from Julie from Trenton. Julie, hi, you're on the air. So you don't think it's such a great system?
Absolutely not.
What's the problem?
Let me tell you, the Medicare Medicaid system is so overly abused these days. I see it firsthand. I work in healthcare, and people all the time, oh, don't worry, I got Medicaid, and they whip out their Medicaid card. Oh, don't worry, I got Medicare. They whip out their card. And, of course, everything is flipped and paid for.
Wait. What's wrong with that? If you live in Canada or England or Italy or France or Sweden or anywhere else in a country that takes care of its people, you whip out your card and you get the care. What's wrong with that?
Well, the thing is A, we pay taxes. Correct?
Yeah.
They take out a Medicare tax, and you get your federal and your state. If you look at that, they take out, you know, I'm middle class, but yeah, what they take out on my pay cut for all the taxes and stuff, I'm barely making it week to week. I have two jobs for a reason. So I can make it and put gas and put food on my table.
Well, you know, this, Julie, I think you're a member of what I call the party of resentment. Rather than looking at, for instance, the fact that one of the reasons that this country got bankrupted was because that Bush gave this tax cut, not to you, not to me, people that it sound like they're working their butt off just to have a decent standard of living. He gave it to all the incredibly rich people, that to the point of almost total $2 trillion. That's what the rich got as a bonus from dear old George W. So rather than aiming, you know, this hostility at people that are getting what you should have and what I should have and what Jolene should have and everybody listening should have, is the ability when you're sick or you feel sick or whatever to go and flash your card just like they do in every single other country in the industrialized world. You know, we're wind up with you know, you resenting poor people that have a Medicare card. You're aiming your hostility at absolutely the wrong people. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here's somebody that's on single-payer universal health care. It's Lars from Madison Heights, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, Peter, I have to call you out for making up a phony statistic earlier.
He caught me.
With the thing about Walmart. I've actually, there's a book about it called The Walmart Effect, where they kind of objectively look over all of Walmart's policies.
Yeah.
And if you divided their, you know, whatever billions of dollars in profit a year equally among all their employees, it'd be the equivalent of raising the average wage from like $9 an hour to $11 an hour. It's not as they only run out of 3% profit margin.
I don't buy that for a second. I mean, I'm talking about the wealth of the Waltons, which is like $60 billion.
Well, no, that'd be forcing them to use their family fortune to subsidize payroll. That's not the same as having a profitable company that could pay $20 an hour.
Wait a minute. Forgetting about that, I'm just saying that they have this money that is parked in their personal fortune that they have no use for whatsoever. It's impossible to consume that amount of of commodities or whatever they want to buy. And instead, they spend their time not getting anything like a decent health plan. I mean, do you admit? I mean, I'm actually sort of surprised you're saying this. You're going off. This stuff, Lars, is put out by these right wing supporters of Walmart and Walmart, who destroys unions, who will shut down a business an outlet of theirs if when people have unionized, trying to get a little more than $9 an hour. And so I don't think it's a phony statistic at all.
What their posted profits and their posted number of employees average out to about $2.
An hour. I hear you. That's not what I'm talking about. I was talking about the personal fortune of these
five members of these
greed heads that will, rather than helping people in the world, will make sure that first off, they destroy lives in the third world because of their forcing people to work for crap wages. That's another thing they could do. They could say to their suppliers, because now they can dictate what they will pay the suppliers in other countries. So they're part of the whole process that have eliminated jobs in this country. So where people say, well, what did they say? They got some slogan, living better, cheaper.
Oh,
like.
Yeah, that new commercial that they've inundated us with.
Yeah, yeah. So they've done this by paying people terrible wages in the third world and by paying people bad wages in this country. It's a buck or so over the minimum wage. And at the same time, they're forcing people that don't have a high income to go where the prices are best, which is Walmart, and so it's circular. So they're assuring that there's never going to be manufacturing back in this country. But thank you for an incorrect correction. And I have to say Lars is a vet, so he gets universal government paid health insurance of the type that probably we should all get. All right. Let's see. Here is Chris in New Mexico. Chris, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Well, hi, guys.
Hi.
Let me just start off by saying, for the record, Julene does play dirty, and she always has.
Thank you.
Yeah, whatever.
I love it.
Can we talk health care for a second here?
Sure.
Okay, it passed in the House last night, which is wonderful. Now it runs to the Senate, and everyone's talking about that doinker Lieberman and how he's going to filibuster the vote. Look, I don't know why nobody's talking about this, and I don't know if I've talked about this before with you, but it's very simple. With a simple majority, 51 votes, the Senate can change the rules on filibuster. You remember the Gang of 14 and the nuclear option a few years ago in 2005?
Sure.
Well, the same thing applies, and that was when the GOP only had a 55-44 majority, and 14 people stood up, McCain and Lieberman in the lead, and stopped them. But that was judicial nominations. They wanted to stop filibusters against judicial nominations for appellate judges and Supreme Court judges, which is something that happens every year. If the Senate wanted to, with a simple majority, 51 votes, they could say, okay, You can't filibuster against your caucus. That takes Lieberman completely out of it. They could say, okay, we have a temporary ban on filibustering against health care bills. They can do that. They can change the rules on filibuster no matter how to, any way they want. It might not be popular, but it would get it through.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, all of this has a certain assumption to it that, I mean, I think you're coming from the best of thinking about it. But it's based on the assumption that somehow we're going to really alter something by going round and round on this merry-go-round with the Republicans and the Democrats. And you see that already. I mean, in Virginia and New Jersey, people said, oh, these Democrats that are in there, they're not doing what they should. So let's get the Republicans in. Yeah, I mean, what a good idea. And maybe they'll even make lots of, the Republicans will make lots of gains in 2010, and then you'll say, oh, man, they haven't done those. You know, so, I mean, we've got to break the lock. I mean, Lieberman is so in debt, although I don't know why I'm singling him out, to the insurance companies, because many of them are headquartered in Connecticut, where he's from. But the tens of millions of dollars that the insurance companies have pumped into the campaign funds of so many Republicans and Democrats, it's hopeless if we're depending on them. I mean, until we get to the point where we depend on us, and that we haven't reached that point yet in the kind of movements that demand a real change, not slogan change, we're going to stay on the merry-go-round.
Okay. All I'm saying is that the Democrats, if they want to, have 51 votes now.
And I agree. And they could do it. But you know what? They won't. All right, Chris, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's an email that's come to calltalkyes@yahoo.com from y'all. I'm of the mind that many of those who demand small government would never support a small military. Yet small government would be impossible without a small military because the military is part of the government. But thanks
that's
to Reagan
point.
And his mathematically impossible beliefs, many people believe that small government with a giant military is entirely possible. And he doesn't say, but I do. And desirable. And until someone can prove to me that 2 + 2 = fish, then I'll never believe that small government with a giant military is possible.
Mm.
Well, I'm not sure I entirely agree. I mean, I hear you, y'all, but what really would happen would be a completely militarized state that as that one whack job conservative that we quoted earlier, gets rid of, instead of having a health care reform, gets rid of Medicare, gets rid of Medicaid, gets rid of Social Security, so we can turn everything over to the 30 years war that we're going to be involved in.
Oh, boy.
I forgot that was 19. I have something on my website about that. The 30 years war was 1618 to 1648. And so we're already in an 8-year war. Right, you know, with society.
And look at Afghanistan. Wow.
Maybe we'll talk about that when we come back.
Okay.
Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, and you all, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene. We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. Sign up to donate blood with 101 WRIF and the American Red Cross over Thanksgiving weekend. If you make and keep your appointment, you'll get your choice of Detroit Pistons tickets or a Dearborn brand gift certificate. Other treats include a chance at a $1,000 shopping spree. Get all the details now at WRIF.com.
Oh, yeah.
Did I win?
I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your one ride-in free station, 101.
Who are you?
WRIF.
Who are you?
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
I'm Rav Lyko 3G at the IT Store. Download the free WRIF app. Connect with just one touch and listen to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Is it wrong that I was totally aroused by that?
Details at WRIF.com. From 101.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Hi, we're back. I like this.
I do too. Mike Gagliano. We love you.
Yeah.
We needed fresh new production on this show in a bad way. Yeah. So there
it's
you go.
About 5 years.
How long
have we been doing this?
Well, in this version of the show, it's been about 3, hasn't it?
That's all.
I think so. Why does it seem like a lot longer?
It does, but in a good way. If you'd like to make some sense out of what's going on with Afghanistan as we enter our 9th year of war, there's going to be a dialogue on American foreign policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it is going to be on Saturday, November 14th. That's coming up at the Royal Oak First United Methodist Church, which is at 320 West 7th Street between Lafayette and Washington. It features Juan Cole, C-O-L-E. In fact, Google him if you want some good, interesting information about the Muslim world. Juan Cole, C-O-L-E, University of Michigan professor of history, author of Engaging the Muslim World. They also invited somebody from the U.S. State Department. I bet they don't show. It'll be 1:30 in the afternoon, and you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and go to the calendar page, which you can book, you see a little skyline in Detroit over on the left. Lots of other good stuff. What else is there? Let me just look real quickly. Oh, yeah. The U.S. has the world's best health care. Read this. That's the Nicholas Kristof column.
Mm-hmm.
Then also, Carrie Prejean, Miss California USA sex tape.
We get just way too much joy out of this stuff.
You can read the history of the European 30 Years' War. All you got to do is, I say on the site, substitute the appropriate countries for today's wars, like us and some other stuff like that. Oh, yeah, also, at 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Anthony Lewis. He wrote a book called The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, and also the wonderful Francis Moore LePay, who wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet,
that
is involved in tons of other good stuff. All right, let's get back to our phones, and here's Melissa in Newport. Melissa, hi. Thanks for being so patient. You're on the air.
Hi, no problem. Thank you for having me on the air. I was calling. I know you wanted to kind of maybe switch the subject, but I wanted to talk to you about the insurance problem.
No, that's fine.
Oh, that's fine, yeah.
I called in earlier this year, and I was telling you about how I have 4 kids, and we had to come up with a lot of money to pay for my son's surgery, even though we had insurance.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Well, since then, we've decided to discontinue the insurance because it didn't cover anything anyway and save ourselves the $600 a month that we were paying.
Oh.
And we cannot get insurance anywhere. We've called, you know, like all the different insurance brokers, and we're pretty much uninsurable. And what I think is frustrating that people don't realize is middle-class people, like my husband and I, you know, we're strapped with the big mortgage, and, you know, we have 4 children and a lot of expenses. We're still willing to pay for insurance, but we cannot get it because we have pre-existing, you know, rated conditions that people don't understand that unless they've tried to buy an individual policy. And it's convenient for those to judge who are, you know, comfortable in their insurance policy. But it's not fair to the rest of us who can't access insurance.
Absolutely.
That's right.
You know, Melissa, there right now is a prime minister in Canada who's a conservative. Are you with me still?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. There's a conservative prime minister in Canada, and you know what he did to try to get rid of the national health program? Nothing. There'll probably be a conservative prime minister of England. You know what he'll do to get rid of the English health system that's paid for by the government? Nothing. People would riot in the streets. I mean, it would be like in this country if all of a sudden they started saying, you got four kids? Okay, well, you got to pay for elementary, junior high and high school, for instance. I mean, it's inconceivable to people in any other country that there's not a universal health plan that everybody has access to. I mean,
right. And with the four kids, I don't expect it to be anyone else's burden. I don't want something for free.
You just want to be able to get some health care.
Right.
You want to purchase.
I think every citizen of this country, whether they be rich, poor, middle class, has a right to medical treatment. It doesn't matter whether you have insurance or not. I think it's unfair to sit here and lay awake at night, you know, praying when my son has a fever, oh, you know, do I need to take him in? Do I have the money to take him in? It's always about money, and it shouldn't be like that. I shouldn't be putting a price tag on my children's health.
Of course not.
You know? And I haven't been to the doctor in probably 4 years. You know, like, I would love to go get a physical. You know, like, God forbid there's something wrong with my husband or I, and we end up dying prematurely because we weren't able to go to the doctor on a regular basis.
Well, I wonder.
It's very frustrating.
I wonder. I bet I won't get a single call. But I would invite conservatives that are against a universal single-payer health program for this country, like all the other industrialized countries, or some variant of that, to call in and say what Melissa should do, what Melissa and her husband and her four kids should do. I mean, probably a lot of them are just thinking, screw them, I got mine. You know,
well, a lot of them are going to say, oh, well, you should try to get my child, because that's what everybody thinks. And people don't understand that if you make more than a certain amount, which is minuscule, you don't qualify for my child.
My
mortgage payment is more than my child.
My child is MI, Michigan.
Yeah.
So. You have to make less than like $1,800 a month for a family of six. I'm sorry, that's not doable. You know, I mean, how could you pay for anything? How could you drive a vehicle where you have a car note or make a mortgage payment? You couldn't.
Right.
Well,
it's ridiculous.
You'll probably be unpleased to learn that the Pentagon is requesting another 60 or 70 billion to fight these wars. That's on top of the 130 billion that Congress authorized for wars just last month. This would be a year's health program for everybody in this country.
I know, and it's very sad that the government doesn't value the health and well-being of their citizens. And all these conservatives that have insurance are comfortable, you know, having that card in their wallet and knowing they can go to the doctor whenever they get a sniffle. Yeah, that's fine. I hope they sleep well at night. But there's people like me who don't have insurance, who want insurance, who the bigwigs and the insurance companies set up all these rules and regulations, so we don't qualify. And I'm willing to pay for it. You know, like, I could probably swing $1,000 a month.
Oh.
I'm willing to pay that. I will do whatever I have to do, get a second job, whatever. We cannot get it because of pre-existing conditions we have. That's unfair.
It is. I mean, you're such a poster family for universal single-payer health care. I wonder what, maybe we'll get some of these people. But, Melissa, thank you for the story, and keep checking back with us, okay?
All right, thank you for having me.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You know, I just get, on one hand, so angry. This is the second time we've heard parts of her story.
Yeah.
And I also get almost embarrassed, you know.
It's very embarrassing and ashamed of, I hate to say it, but ashamed of how our government treats our people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right, don't jump, all right?
Okay.
Out of the the palace, into the ditch. Well, that's a little too extreme, but
but you love it.
Congress has 237 millionaires among it. Can you believe that?
Yes.
That's 44% of the body compared to about 1% of Americans overall. So if you make $1 million, you're in the top 1%. But and according to the CRP, what in the world is that? Center for Responsive Politics says the richest is California Republican Daryl Issa, and far right winger, of course, and doesn't want universal health care or any health care. He's a net. He has a net worth estimated at $250 million. But then it's amazing. It's all Democrats. Jane Harman, who's a congresswoman from California, she's worth about the same, $250 million. Herb Kohl,
wow,
senator, $214 billion. Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, $209 million. John Kerry, $208 million.
Oh my gosh!
I think he married into that.
Oh yeah, the Hines family,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Senators' estimated median reportable worth sunk to about $1.79 million from $2.27 million in 2007. The House's median income was significantly lower and also sank, bottoming out at
$622,000. My God.
23 private college presidents made more than $1 million. They were paid a median compensation of $627,000. And the highest pay went to Shirley Ann Jackson, who's president of the well-known educational institution, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York.
What?
She had a pay package totaling $1,598,000. I mean, just think, if you took the first two numbers off of that, how this would be, this would put you in the top 5%, 98,000. But she's getting $1,598,000. She's followed by David J. Sargent of another well-known university, Suffolk University Boston. And he got $1.5 million almost. Stedman Upton of the University of Tulsa, $1.5 million as well. According to the survey published in Monday's edition of something, 23 private college presidents made over $1 million in total compensation, and 110 made more than $500,000. Such large pay packages are still relatively new in higher education, blah, blah, blah. But let me see. Overall, the Chronicle survey. What is the Chronicle? Oh, the Chronicle of Higher Education. Pardon me. It's found the median pay for presidents of the 419 private colleges and universities surveyed was $358,000, a 6.5% increase over the previous year. Over the last 5 years, the median presidential pay adjusted for inflation grew by 14%. Of course, that's followed by the article that says the price of a college education rose substantially last year.
Wow. We have to pay all those big bucks.
This is so. Patrick Callahan, president of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, called the increases hugely disappointing. All right. Okay, let's go back and get some more of your calls. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jeff in Detroit. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Jalene.
Hi.
Hello.
You know, one of the things I hate is when these people are talking about they don't want big government. I think basically, especially when you're talking about on the federal level, I think they just want a big military and a government that does nothing for the people.
I guess. I can't understand why.
I mean, you know, that you would think that, I think when you were talking about the politics of resentment, I think that is so much of a part of how some people feel, especially on the right, that all they think about is, I don't want, you know, those people or them, they, whoever they think of, to get something for nothing. And I think that, you know, when you start really start talking to people and they start talking about how they view things, and that you realize that some people don't feel that it's a right to get health care as a birthright. They think of it as a privilege, and it shouldn't be.
Well, it depends. I mean, that's, see, as I've said numerous times over the last few weeks, conservatives want to conserve things as they are. So right now, health care is not a right in this country. It is in Canada and England and Italy and France and Sweden, Finland and Denmark and all that. It's considered a right, just like we figure we have the right to a free school system and a free police system and a free fire system. I mean, it's paid for by taxes, but all of our money goes to these endless wars, this bloated military budget, you know, and... So that's where it all goes. And tax cuts for the rich. Well, no wonder there's a little problem about financing a system, even though Obama says that his program won't cost anything. In fact, may reduce the deficit. But I don't know. We shall see. All right. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate your comments. Let's see. Here. Oh, I don't have a name here. It is a caller from Ann Arbor. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Jolene. It's John from Ann Arbor.
Hi, John.
Hey, John.
And I wanted to first say I have the pleasure of hearing Juan Cole speak, and I have met him. And I recommend anybody that can get there. It's a great speech.
I should remind people if they're just listening, this is Juan Cole is going to be speaking in Royal Oak on Saturday. As I said, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and go to the calendar page, and you'll see what John is talking about. Go ahead.
Yes. And, well, where should I start? I am real thankful to be on Medicare, and it has helped me for the first female caller that said it's not working. It's working just fine.
And she's not having. She's not on it.
No, not the last one. The very first one. I've been on for a while. The last caller. I'm insured, and I could be the person that doesn't care. But no, I'm still lobbying for public option because of the last female caller. We definitely need public option. There's no other way around it.
Well, here, John. Here's where the politics of resentment comes in, and one can almost understand that because it takes some. Psychological courage to confront your betters. I mean, we shouldn't have that kind of conception in a democratic country, and we thought we'd left royalty way behind. But usually what comes out in the politics of resentment, in what I call the party of resentment, is you look at those below you. But if you can imagine someone like the caller said, she has to work two jobs, she works her butt off, she probably, like Melissa and her family, does not qualify for any government aid. She pays taxes. She doesn't get a lot for it. As I said, a lot of it's going to the military and all that. And then she sees a poor person being able to go in and not paying any copays, not paying anything for the policy itself, and show their card. And so rather than resenting the system that put this into motion, rather than resenting the people that control the system so they work it to their advantage and to the disadvantage, not only of the middle class, I mean, there's obviously poor people, but working class and middle class people, they dislike the people below them. So
I see, I'm following you there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was talking at first about the first lady that worked in the healthcare. And
right, no, that's what I'm talking about.
And what I was saying is that she thinks it's okay. Or she thinks it's not okay because she's not on it. If she were on it and needed it, she would think it was okay.
Yeah.
Well, and it works fine. I need a Bend a Gap policy to pay for my transplant medicines, you know, the extra 20%. But other than that, Medicare is great, and I think that if we can get these damn politicians off their butts and get it going, it would work for everybody.
John, let me ask you this.
Now I know who John is. He's one of my friends on Facebook.
You are.
Yes. He had a double lung transplant.
Wow.
He did, yeah.
Wow.
And we were talking about the Republicans running amok earlier.
Hey, right. John, tell me Medicare. So you're on, what do they call it, Part B?
A and B. A is hospital coverage, and that doesn't cost anything. Part B is your doctor and other coverage. No drugs, though.
That's Medicare D.
For that.
So what is it all?
Medicare B cost me $96 a month.
Ooh, I said 60.
But that does not include your medication?
No, I have to pay another $50 for my plan B for drugs.
And it's 150, and do you carry supplemental insurance to cover the rest of it that's not paid?
Except for my transplant drugs. If Medicare pays for your transplant except for kidneys, this is where it's complicated. You got to do your research.
I guess so.
For a lung transplant, Medicare B pays for my anti-rejection drugs 80%.
Wow. Well,
all the rest of them, I need a D coverage.
Well, you understand under, I mean, who, wait a minute, who's that guy from Florida that now that Alan, this congressman that said that the Republican health plan is, you know, essentially someone like you, you'd die, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had to survive, once I got a disability, I had to survive the 2 years to get the Medicare. But
wow.
I managed to do that, so I'm thankful.
Gosh,
and
yeah.
I do like to help people like the last, that lady, the last caller. We need insurance. And for that, I will say goodnight. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Thank you, John.
And I will be commenting, Julie.
Okay.
And good health.
Bye, John.
Good health to you.
Yes.
And
once again, I'm glad that you are getting that help.
Yeah, for sure. Here's Carol in Detroit. Carol, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. It's nice to talk to you. I wanted to... I heard a guy, his name was Reed, I believe, that wrote a book about...
T.R. Reed.
Yeah. There's going to be on PBS at 10 o'clock on Tuesday on Frontline, Sick Around the World.
Yeah, that's what he's written a book about. And he looked at all the health systems around the world.
Yeah, I heard him interviewed, and when I saw it was going to be on there, I thought somebody might want us to watch it.
Yeah, no, that's a
right,
that's,
true.
That's a great tip.
Expose it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, on 56 at 10 o'clock on Tuesday.
What?
Channel 56.
Oh. I'm
10
sorry.
O'clock
I thought
Tuesday.
I thought you were saying you were 56. I was going to say. Well,
no, I'm not that young. I voted for Dennis when I could.
Dennis Kucinich.
Yes.
Yeah, but you're hip.
I should read his why he voted against the health care bill. Because it's so inadequate. All right, Carol, thank you for that. T.R. Reed is absolutely incredible. R-E-I-D. Google him. Get his book. Thank you. Here is Eric in Ypsilanti, 313-298-WRIF. Eric, hi. You're on the air.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Hey, good morning.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. First of all, I would like to send my condolences to the victims of a shooting in Fort Hood down there in Texas.
Sure.
Yeah.
And their families.
Mm-hmm.
You know that some of those people, I was looking at all the, they had little profiles of the victims, and some of the people that were shot and killed were like 62 years old.
I know.
They
it
were,
was quite the
and
age.
Then, and then there was like 19-year-olds and a young woman who was pregnant who was 21.
26 or something.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Go ahead, Eric.
Second of all, I have some... I mean, I do support universal health care for all Americans, but I have some problems with this health care bill as it is.
Yeah.
Because of the fines you have to pay for not getting health care insurance, because some people in this country don't live anywhere near a hospital or a clinic. They live in rural areas.
Sure, I got to find out what this is all about. I mean, say you're making $22,000 a year and they're going to force you to have health insurance? I mean, that sounds pretty crazy. I mean, it is like you could also say, well, I'm not going to have any auto insurance, but you are required to have auto insurance,
yes,
obviously.
Yes.
And the argument is that they are socializing risk. That is to say, I mean, a lot of young people who don't have health insurance. I mean, when I was in my early 20s, I didn't have health insurance.
Right.
And I never went to a doctor, never needed to go to a doctor. But if you have, if everyone in the pool is, you know, older and more at health risk, well, then, you know, that there's more risk for payouts. And if we're at a for-profit system the way it is, and this bill doesn't change any of that. So the idea is that everybody has to be in it, regardless of your health status, and that will spread the risk out. But I think that's got to go. I mean, that's why you got to have universal single-payer health care, so you don't have anybody paying anything. You don't pay anything in Canada or Switzerland or Liechtenstein. Or Andorra, into the little countries.
Yes, but even they have problems there.
Oh, yeah.
And also, I'm 24 years old. I'm an independent, not a Democrat nor a Republican.
Right.
Neither are we.
We're not Democrats
or
Republicans. Yeah.
Right.
We're definitely not Republicans.
Definitely.
Well, unfortunately, I think about switching parties to a Republican. I'm sorry.
Well,
you should be.
That's, I wish I had my AC/DC up. I'd play Highway to Hell.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't go to the dark side,
nothing,
man.
There's nothing there. I mean, listen, just because, the Democrats, I mean, here's what I do. Here's the way I vote. That's why I voted for Barack Obama. That's why I would vote for Democrats. They are the lesser of the two evils. And people say, are you just going to keep voting for the lesser of the two evils? Well, it's
probably.
Well, until we get the mass movement together that parallels the civil rights movement and the women's suffragette and the union movement and stuff like that, where millions of people came together and shook the corridors of power till they either let more people in or gave us what we want. Things like, the five-day week and for the union movement and eight-hour day and all of that. In the meantime, I want to have the lesser of the two evils in power, not the greater, even if they aren't
perfect.
Or anywhere near it.
Right.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. Here is Mike in Windsor. Thanks for making our show international. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. I'm calling for Windsor, obviously, and I'm not pro Democrat or Republican. I'm quite neutral on the subject, and from an outsider's looking in with a different healthcare system over here, I can't understand how anyone can function financially in America.
Thank you. Exactly. This is what I talk about all the time on this show, Peter, about the people in other countries. But just look at it. This is complete insanity.
Yeah, like to us, this is madness. Like, I went to the hospital this week. I had I got injured, and I got I had three fractures in my face. I missed a whole week of work. And, like, SNA over here will cover probably my week of work off.
What's SNA?
Sick and absent, basically. Like, you can't work. It's like an insurance that we all pay into. Obviously,
yeah.
I mean, the thing I guess I can't understand with the United States is no one wants their taxes to go up, but everybody wants services increased. And obviously, it's impossible. Everybody wants more for less, and if you follow that to the end, you have everything for nothing.
Well, yeah, for sure. But let me, that's the reason I'm asking you this, because it leads to something. May I ask you your age?
I'm 25.
All right, well.
I live on my own. I go to the University of Windsor.
Well, a lot of 25-year-olds in this country, and like when I was 25, I didn't have any health insurance and never had any need for it. But you know what? If you had an injury like that, you know what? How many thousands of dollars you owe?
It costed me about $300 in total for my dental. I saw two oral surgeons, multiple appointments with dentists, oral surgeons, a night in the ER, CAT scan, and, nothing out of pocket, obviously, right? And I independent, live on my own, pay for school on my own, and obviously the government backs me, but obviously every paycheck I back them. So what I don't understand is how someone who makes, like a congressman or an elitist in your economy who makes the top 5% can say to, another 250 million people, you don't deserve the same treatment we do. To me, that's unthinkable. Like, we're all equals. Like, we should all put in the same pot, and we should all be able to get the same rights. Like, we're all entitled. If you're all entitled to bear arms, aren't you all entitled to, to health care? It doesn't make any sense.
Great point.
But the reason I think it is that a lot of people in the United States don't talk about is because big pharma, your major five pharmaceutical companies that are based in the United States, gross over $200 billion a year in just prescription drugs alone. And Americans are exploited by this because they pay more for pharmaceutical drugs than any other industrialized nation. Because what happens is new drugs are introduced constantly into the market that are just replacing old ones with new patents where they've changed it in order to perpetuate the constant rise in costs of prescription drugs.
Yeah, the TV commercials. You see American television over there, so you've seen.
Well, so we get ripped off and taken.
Yeah. And that's a stat from, 2002. So, and that's supposed to go up 12% every year from 2002. So you're probably over at $300 billion now. So, I mean, to me, I'm a communications major, and we study this subject deeply. I can't understand how anyone doesn't realize that they're being just exploited for the revenue that they create.
Yeah. That's so true.
You're living in a society that perpetuates itself because the lobbyists who work for these big companies pay your congressmen, they back pay them, they support them, who make the policies for you. How does that make any sense?
Too bad more people in this country don't get it like you'd get it there.
Kind of corrupt.
Yeah.
All right, hey, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate all that.
No problem. Have a good night.
All right, and get better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't want to ask him how it sounded like he had gotten severe facial injury.
Something, I don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob wrote in, Rob, a listener, and this is really going to make you happy, although part of it makes me extremely happy. But notice Melissa, this is for our caller before, didn't mention anything about her job. My advice is get a job, in capital letters. Most supply employers insurance. Michigan Hospital is always hiring, and it provides insurance for even part-time jobs. Go there, get a job. And then he says, Pete, love you, hate progressivism. And he says to me, this is the biggest compliment ever. Judy, that's my name. Judy is worse than Rachel Maddow. Yay! God, oh, my God.
I love Rachel Maddow.
I love her. Yeah. So I, what he's saying is I'm, crazier than her. And so whatever.
Well, how is this all going to be paid for, the health care, inadequate as many progressives think it is, the health care reform bill that passed the House? The typical middle-class family would be spared higher taxes from the House Democratic plan to overhaul health care, and their low-income neighbors could come out ahead. Their wealthy counterparts, however, face a big tax increase. The bill is funded largely from a 5.4% tax on individuals making more than $500,000 a year and couples making more than $1 million. The tax increase would hit only 0.3% of tax filers, raising $460 billion over the next 10 years, according to congressional estimates. Let's see what's on the next page. In 2011, a family of four with an income of $800,000 a year would get a $24,000 tax increase. With the new taxes combined with an increase in the top two tax brackets proposed by President Obama and other scheduled tax changes, that's a 12.5% increase in federal taxes. A family of four making $5 million a year would see a $434,000 tax increase, about a 32% increase. Good. Should be more, actually. And that way, now here's what I don't understand. Here's what you could do, and I haven't talked about this in a while. We could have a tax deduction of $50,000 for everybody. In other words, if you made $60,000 a year, you'd pay taxes on $10,000. If you made $45,000 a year, you'd make nothing. And what you'd pay nothing in taxes. And so what you got to do, though, is extremely increase the tax structure on the upper 10%, particularly the upper 5%, and really, really gouge the upper 1% that have way, way too much money and have just have not paid back to us what we had, the wealth that we've created, because our productivity as American citizens has increased extraordinarily. But beginning with the hideous Reagan administration and all the policies that have brought us to where we are today, our wages have remained flat, and their wealth, that 1%, that 5%, has...
Yeah, or it's gone down, I mean, in reality for people.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Bob in Macomb. Bob, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
Good. First time, I've never heard your show, so I don't even know who I'm really talking to. But,
wow.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
Okay. Well, you wanted to talk to a conservative, so I want to talk to you about what's going on.
I had a feeling he was going here. Go for it.
Well, I don't know what you want to talk about, because you wanted to talk about how you want to dispute this, but where, and you know, I listened to the woman about maybe four callers back, and I feel sorry for her.
What?
I'm an unemployed Republican with a bachelor's degree, halfway through my master's degree, and can't get a job. So I have a Down syndrome child, and under this wonderful establishment that we have going now with this health care bill, they are not going to cover my son. And because it's, again, pre-existing condition, an issue where, you know what, they're going to decide whether or not it's right for him to live or die.
Wait, Bob, you are just repeating all this absolute nonsense. There's nobody who's going to make those decisions. And, you know,
Fox News has gotten to you.
Yeah. Where do you come up with this stuff?
Why do you call it nonsense when it's proven that inside the bill that even, you know, you want to support this president that we...
I don't want to support this president at all. He's totally inadequate as far as I'm concerned. He's much closer to your politics than he is to mine, believe it.
Oh, boy, I don't know about that.
Well, you don't know what our politics are,
yeah,
then.
Yeah, you've had how long? An hour?
Yeah. Listen, and for any deficiency that you may see in this health care bill, there's some I might even agree with. I mean, I would agree, you know, that it's not extensive enough coverage. It still allows these for-profit, firms to continue to make extraordinary profits off of our illnesses and unfortunate situations like your son. And why somebody that's unemployed, that has a major health problem in their family would be a conservative is so far beyond me. You've probably been reading Ayn Rand or something like that, right?
No, I don't even bother reading because politics makes me sick to my stomach. I just happened to turn on the radio because I was coming home from Dave and Buster's.
Why are you a conservative then? I mean, you're saying essentially I don't know anything about politics, but I might as well hang out with the, you know, with the richest people that support privilege and...
Who don't care about you or your son.
And couldn't care less about you. They laugh when they find out that poor people like yourself support their policies.
Number one, I never said I was poor. I said I was unemployed. I was smart with what I've done in the past, and that's how I handled things. I didn't let the government handle my stuff.
All right. It's every man for himself and God against all.
I guess so.
All right. It's dog eat dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fend for yourself, for sure.
All right. Good luck, man. You're going to need it. All right. All right, hey, we got to take a break. That's why I cut him off. 313-298-WRIF.
It had nothing to do with what you said.
No.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Did I win? I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday. Exclusively from your walk right in free station, 101.
Who are you?
WRIF. Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
Did you know that tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging lime scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, which costs you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system, guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
Whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free and the relief is real.
Call Credit Card Relief at 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call now. 1-866-290-8282.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
There's something happening across America. People aren't just calling themselves DirecTV customers. They're calling themselves fans. That's because DirecTV has exclusive sports packages like NFL Sunday Ticket and free NASCAR Hot Pass. DirecTV has the most HD channels with over 130, soon to be over 200, and 50 times more movies available than 1080p. Perhaps that's why DirecTV is ranked number one in customer satisfaction among all TV service providers. So don't just watch TV. Become a huge fan. Switch to DirecTV today. Call 1-888-359-5566. There's no equipment to buy and no startup costs. Packages start at just $29.99 a month. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566. Sports subscriptions sold separately. New customers only on approved credit. Credit card required except Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. Hardware lease and programming commitment required and available separately. Other conditions apply. Call for details.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
I screwed that up.
Back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Julian
that's
Jordan.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got too many numbers here in this digital system. A couple of elections. We'll get right back to your calls. 313-298-WRIF. The Democrats lost in New Jersey and Virginia, mostly because...
The governor's races,
yeah. This far right-wing conservative, actually the conservative party, the conservatives, people like Sarah Palin and all these guys on Fox News thought that the Republican wasn't far right enough, so they backed this conservative candidate. The Republican candidate withdrew and endorsed the Democrat, and the Democrat won. This, I don't know which is tells more for the Democrats' prospects, but the Democrats won the seat in upstate New York that they hadn't held in 150 years or something like that.
Yeah, there's all this hate and, you know, spreading the hatred, yeah. The fear, everything else we're seeing from these like Tea Party types, Fox
yep.
News.
Maine voters disgraced themselves by repealing a state law that would have allowed same-sex couples to wed, dealing the gay rights movement a heartbreaking defeat in New England. Gay marriage now is lost in every single state, 31 in all, in which it has been put to a popular vote. Well, you can. I'm sure that if you would have put civil rights for African American people on the ballot, say mm-hmm. like in the 1920s and 1930s yeah. and 1940s, they would have lost big time as well.
Right. Just but, one of those things is going to take time.
So, essentially, you know, just as conservatives wanted to conserve slavery, and just like they wanted to conserve segregation.
Yeah, and they definitely didn't want to, like, you know, loudmouth women like me voting.
Yeah, they wanted to conserve male-only only voting. And they even had, law, because the conservative justices of the Supreme Court, I think it was 1896, in a case called Plessy versus Ferguson, upheld segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And it held for over half a century. So,
an awful piece of legislation.
Yeah. So let's see what else. At the same time, Maine became the fifth state to allow pot dispensaries.
Yeah. So you know, you can smoke away, but don't be gay.
Mm-hmm.
I just came up with
That's very good.
Thank you.
The director of the Maine Drug Enforcement Agency said the language of the Maine referendum lacks proper oversight and control. He said if there isn't sufficient oversight, inspection, audits, etc., the potential is there for criminal activity to flourish. People may smoke flowers and change their consciousness.
Oh, boy.
Call the cops.
Radical stuff.
Call the cops. People are dead. You know. Anyway.
Get over it.
Yeah. Let's see. Here is Bob in Westland. Bob, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Bob.
Bob. How you doing?
Good. You guys, big time fan of you guys.
Well, thank you.
Glad you're on here. Got all these right wing nut jobs out here. But I was calling about the shooting down in Fort Hood.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd like to just say, you know, it's just more of the right wingers, you know, and I think they're more to blame than the actual shooter.
Well, at some point, you know, you got to stop. It's got to stop. Responsibility has to stop at a certain point.
And, but, you know, I mean, it goes back to we've been murdering Palestinians for how long now? And, you know, nobody seems to care about anybody in the Middle East dying. And, you know, a handful of people die in Fort Hood, and I feel real bad for them.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing, because, you know, we're so separated from what's going on over there. I mean, for the longest time, they weren't even allowing any, you know, caskets to be shown on television or anything like that, or dead bodies, for that matter, civilians. And so no one cares about the civilians over there. I mean, we do.
Yeah, well, and just for accuracy's sake, we haven't killed any Palestinians, just our tax dollars funding the military
thank
of
you.
Israel. All right.
And that. I mean, we could go on and
much.
On about this.
Yep. Let's see. Here's Julie in Trenton. Julie, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
All right. First of all, you didn't let me finish what I was saying earlier.
You were on before. You only get to be on once. You'll have to call back next week. Let's see. Here's Jeff and Warren. Jeff, hi. You're on the air.
We have one rule, and that's it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Did I not do this?
I think I hear it. Sounds like a mouse.
Yeah. Jeff is a nurse. I'd like to hear from him. Call back.
I thought I heard something scratching around back there.
Here's Richard in Farmington. Richard, hi. And there's some open lines, finally. 313-298-WRIF. Richard, you're on the air.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. I was watching the news the day after that shooting at Fort Hood, and they reported that the gunman had bought his gun in Killeen, Texas, which is to Fort Hood what Mount Clemens would be to Selfridge Air National Guard Base. They're adjacent. And when they said Killeen, Texas, I was it rang a bell. And I thought, you know, Luby's Cafeteria. And I Googled it, and it turns out that in 1991, a guy drove into a restaurant there and got out and started shooting, and he killed 24 people.
The Luby's. I remember that.
Wow.
Exactly. It was the worst mass murder in U.S. history at the time.
Right.
And I'm thinking, this guy kills 13 people. And then they showed a picture of the gun store in Killeen, and it's what you'd expect. One of these big buildings, you know, guns, big signs of guns, ammo, American flag. And it turns out that this wasn't the... not only was it not the worst mass killing in Texas history, it wasn't even the worst mass killing in Killeen, Texas history.
Wow.
And that just said something to me that you know, they could have two events like that in a span of 18 years, you know, in a place where it's all about God and guns. And,
yeah.
Well, you know, our friend Greg Palast, you go to Greg Palast, PALAST.com. One of his books is called Armed Madhouse. And we want to ignore that because most gun owners we know are responsible and don't do stuff like that. But it's like the more miles you drive, the more incidents, the more possible the incident of an accident. In the same way, the more that gun ownership proliferates, the more chance for things like this, even if it's only 0.5% that ever do anything illegal. And there is a mass murder a week on this incident in Orlando, Florida, where this guy went into this firm where he had worked, and you know, he only killed
one person, injured like seven or five,
wounded five other people. So in order to keep all our guns, you know, we have to put up with these continual mass massacres.
Elaine Boozler wrote a great article after Virginia Tech. It was called "We're Tired of Prying Your Guns from Your Cold Dead Fingers."
Wow!
And I would I'd encourage anybody to Google that and read it. It was really quite remarkable.
She's a comedian. Obviously, a comedian with a conscience, huh?
And a brain, yeah.
And a brain, way.
All right, thank you very much.
Damn those crazy women with brains.
Let's try Jeff again. Jeff, are you with us? Jeff, I wonder what he's doing. I mean, he's a nurse. I kind of wanted to hear from him.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe Roger, see if you, Roger's on it.
Roger is on it.
On it.
Here's Eric in Belleville. Hi, Eric. Eric.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing. We're good. I can say it. Go ahead.
You can tell it's the end of the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, what's up?
Doing the show.
You tell us, Eric. Yeah.
Oh, nothing. I'm just hanging out, man.
Okay. Do you want to talk about health care or
guns? We talk about guns. Guns are cool.
Yeah, they're cool.
They're really cool when they, you know, like take out like 20 people at a time.
And then you really need health care.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. What if you got lots of guns and a lot of people getting killed and wounded? Well, you know, killed doesn't matter. You don't need any health care, but you could. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. let's see. Here's Nick in Lincoln Park. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Nick, you tell us.
Well, first of all, I think one of the main problems that's going on is overpopulation in the United States.
I think overpopulation in general. Why do these people, I'm sorry, but feel the need to just keep having babies?
It's like you got all these.
I didn't have any, so I can say this.
And whatnot, and the unemployment rates. And
I just think people, you know, have too. I think there's just too many kids.
Well, people aren't poor in Mexico because of overpopulation. One of the densest.
No, I'm not agreeing with that at all. Yeah. I'm just saying in general, what's with the desire to have so many mini-me's? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. All right, thank you. Let's see here. Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Cleveland and presidential candidate in the last election, said, "We've been led to believe that we must make our health care choices only within the current structure of a predatory for-profit insurance system which makes money not providing health care. It makes money. The insurance system, as it is now, makes money by not providing health care," says Dennis Kucinich, and who voted against the House bill. "We cannot fault the insurance companies for being what they are, but we can fault legislation in which the government incentivizes the strengthening of the for-profit health insurance industry, the very source of the problem. Clearly, the insurance companies are the problem, not the solution. They are driving up the cost of health care. Because their massive bureaucracy avoids paying bills so effectively, they force hospitals and doctors to hire their own bureaucracy to fight the insurance companies to avoid getting stuck with an unfair share of the bills. The result is that since 1970, the number of physicians has increased by less than 200%, while the number of administrators has increased by 3,000%. It is no wonder that 31 cents of every health care dollar goes to administrative costs, not towards providing care. Even those with insurance are at risk. The single biggest cause of bankruptcies in the U.S. is the health insurance policies did not cover you when you get sick." All right, let's see.
Making this stuff up.
No. Jeff, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
You got me this time.
There you are.
Go ahead.
Hey, bingo bango. Hey, well, you know, I'm a registered nurse, mm-hmm. and, you know, I took the oath to help people as best as I possibly can. I guess, basically, I'm kind of scared as to, do we have the proficiency and do we have the efficiency to serve the amount of people that would be coming in? I'm in a hospital. I'm not going to mention a hospital, but...
Well, I just wonder, how do they do it? Do you know, how they do it in all these other industrialized countries?
Well, what Jeff is saying, we got 46 million people that are uninsured.
Right.
What happens when they all start going to the hospital,
don't you think it would all work itself out? I really do.
Well, I mean, you're, you're talking about, you know, you're kind of jumping the gates. I mean, you know, you don't prepare for a race unless you're going to go out and jog a little bit, you know. And at this particular juncture, I'm waiting 3 days, sometimes 3 days, for just a simple X-ray result.
Right.
And these are people that are you know, already, I guess, insured or even not insured. It doesn't much matter. Now, you're going to open up the floodgates, which obviously people are going to take that option and go into that situation and start, you know, we want results now. We want this. I'm sick. I'm this. I'm that. I mean, I'm in a situation where I'm in a hospital that I haven't even been inoculated for H1N1.
Oh, well, let me just interrupt you 1 second. This bill is not doing, for instance, what Medicare did in 1965. They got everybody over 65 enrolled in like a matter of 6 months or something. They're talking about some of this stuff, not even you know, getting people enrolled in it for like 10 years. So I don't think it's going to be overnight. Although, I'll tell you, if you know, we, and I use that advisedly, if we, the American people, through the government, were really committed to extending health care to everyone, which is kind of unusual. You know, it used to be traditionally that it was only the wealthy that got good health care. And what this is a process of democratization. And to take the burden off of people, I said earlier, to take the burden off of people financially and to take the stress out of it. I mean, we had a caller before that was talking about wasn't eligible for insurance any longer because of pre-existing conditions in her children. And she said she was willing to pay, pardon me, $1,000 a month, which... she still couldn't get any. I mean, that's outrageous. I mean, you can't even buy health insurance.
Yeah, I agree. My mother passed away with pancreatic cancer, and they were all it was all self-funded, going through our Blue Cross, you know, Blue Shield insurance. It basically, you know, kind of wiped them out. Now that's just the insurance policy. Now you want to get in to start paying for the medications that she had to pay for? It's astronomical.
Yeah, it's absolutely outrageous. Jeff, I'm gonna have to cut it short because I've got to get a couple more callers in about a minute or so. So thank you. Hi, Brian. You're on the air. Thanks for calling from Clyde, Michigan. You got to kind of just give me the headlines because we're almost out of time.
Hey, I just wanted to call in and say you were talking about the price of tuition.
Yeah.
There was an article I seen. There was like 5 schools where tuition was $50,000 or more a year in 2007.
Yeah.
2008, there's 58 schools where tuition is more than $50,000 a year.
Now,
I mean,
guess who gets that? The ultra wealthy, the top 1%. Where if we made some real changes in this country, just like high school, college would be free and should be. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Here's Tony in Roseville. Tony, the headlines, and we got to go.
Yeah, the main thing I wanted to say is that I think non-drug and non-surgical treatment should be in the health plan.
Be in the health what?
Plan.
Health plan. Yeah.
Alternative medicine.
Yeah, alternative medicine, Peter.
The government shouldn't have a monopoly on the pharmaceutical industry.
Well,
yeah,
it's got
agreed.
A monopoly on health.
Yeah, I'm just so surprised that these companies aren't all over it. They were for a while. I mean, they're going to get all
over. They're paying for acupuncture and things like that.
They should.
Chiropractic.
Good point. Thank you. Let me just see if I can quickly get the statement of Dennis Kucinich, congressman from Cleveland, as to why he opposed the Obama bill. He said, instead of working towards the elimination of for-profit insurance, the bill that passed would put the government in the role of accelerating the privatization of health care. The government is requiring at least 21 million Americans to buy private health insurance from the very industry that causes costs to be so high, which will result in at least $70 billion in new annual revenue, much of which is coming from taxpayers to these companies. This inevitably will lead to even more costs, more subsidies, and higher profits for insurance companies, a bailout under a Blue Cross. So where does that leave us, unfortunately?
At the end of the show.
At the end of the show. But, Roger, thank you so much
for
answering
our
phones.
Thank you,
Jordan.
To Mike Gagliano for our brand-new whiz-bang production that he put together for the show. Oh, and you're welcome, Peter.
Hey, and stay tuned. We have an interview about the people that made up the Civil Rights Movement, what's become of them, and also Francis Moore LePay.
I'm listening to that one. I'm staying up.
All right. We'll talk next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Ah, Thanksgiving. The food, the family, the zombie.
Wait a minute, what the hell?
101 WRIF presents the Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. Hey, somebody's gonna wake your ass up with a food drama. The Rip has you covered. Rob Zombie, live. Friday, November 27th at the Fillmore Detroit. Tickets available now. Get them exclusively at LiveNation.com. Thanksgiving weekend will never be the same. The Riff. Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. The Fillmore Detroit. Friday, November 27th from your concert station. 101 WRIF. The Riff.
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports stint to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports stint sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports stint you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
Do you owe taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? What will you do? Your tax problem will only get worse if you don't do something about it. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-493-8157. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest, and get the tax collector off your case. As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Here's a quick exercise that will not only get you feeling better, it will save you money too. Just walk to your HR manager's office and ask if your company's flexible spending account program, or FSA, is reimbursing for non-prescription drugs. That's right, over-the-counter medicines. You already know and trust them to help you get relief from aches and pains, cold and flu symptoms, allergies, and more. Now, thanks to an IRS change in tax laws, they're eligible expenses in company FSAs. So ask your employer about non-prescription medicines and your flexible spending account today.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, this whole country is about revolution, isn't it? Oh, it's kind of a bad word for a lot of people. But that's how we began, with a big revolution. And then there's been lots of revolutions since. If you look at the Civil War, if you look at the women's rights movement, the union movement, and, of course, the civil rights movement. All of these movements, mass-based movements of the people, maybe exclude the Civil War from that, but certainly not the abolitionist movement that that brought up the issue of slavery. It's been the people in motion that have made the history of this country, that have extended democracy as far as it can be, and maybe not as far as it should be or will be, but they sure gave it their best. The civil rights movement has gained iconic status. If you think about it, Martin Luther King Jr., a holiday for this man. There isn't one for the women's suffrage movement, and there isn't one for, say, Walter Reuther and the labor movement, but there is because this there is for the civil rights movement, because this was a key moment in American history. There's been a tremendous amount written about it by memoirs of people, and as it begins to fade in terms of time, talking about revolution as the revolution of time moves on, more and more is being looked at, reflected upon. A book has come my way, extraordinarily interesting. It's called The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, and it's about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was called SNCC, and some of you may have heard of it. Hopefully lots of you have. The book is written by Anthony B. Lewis, and Anthony B. Lewis has taught at the University of Richmond, Hamilton College, and Wesleyan University, and with Julian Bond, a very important figure in the civil rights movement, and also in this book, is co-editor of Gonna Sit at the Welcome Table, a documentary history of the civil rights movement. And we welcome Andrew B. Lewis. He's at his home in Concord, Massachusetts, the home of the American Revolution. Andrew Lewis, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, there's... Certainly, the more we know of history, the more we know of our origins, the more able we are to make decisions about today. There's been a tremendous amount written about the civil rights movement. What's new in your book, The Shadows of Youth?
Well, like many people, I got interested in the movement through my admiration for Martin Luther King, but the more I studied, the more I realized that it was more complex than that, and I wanted to drill down and tell a story about some of the activists of it. I always say that if King wrote the poetry of the movement, then SNCC acted out its prose, and it seemed to me that that everyday hard slog of civil rights activism, that story had been forgotten in some ways. And it was... The book was started in many ways as an angry response to something like Taylor Branch's book, which was subtitled America in the King Years. Titles like that drove me insane because I felt there are so many more people, so much more going on, and to lump it in that way was a disservice to the broader idea of the civil rights movement, and SNCC seemed a perfect vehicle to tell that broader story.
Well, let's talk about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It has become a proper noun, and even more so as SNCC, its pronunciation, if you will. Take it apart, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and go back to its origins. And am I correct? In 1960.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee grew out of the sit-ins, which happened first in February 1960 and then spread across the South like wildfire in the spring of 1960. What most people don't remember is that in 1960, what we think of the civil rights movement was flagging. It had been 6 years since the Brown decision, and less than 1% of African-American students in the South attended integrated schools.
For school integration was the Brown decision, right. Go ahead.
That's right. And the Montgomery bus boycott had happened a couple years before, but King himself had had trouble recreating its success, and so the movement was floundering. In fact, it was close to being stillborn, and then the sit-ins happened, and they recharged the protest and recharged the movement and set in motion almost everything we think about the 60s. So in many ways, the sit-ins are the seminal moment of the civil rights movement and end of the 60s themselves.
Well, it's interesting, and I don't know how much of this story to retell because people certainly are aware of a lot of it, but the sit-ins that we're talking about, among others, were simply about public accommodations for a person of African descent to be able to sit at a lunch counter or go into a certain door or use the same drinking fountain. Certainly everybody knows the drinking fountain story. So this was, almost incredible that that by mid-century in the 20th century that there had to be this movement for public accommodations, but it was met with incredible violence from a group that was committed to nonviolence, as its name states, right?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, one of the things about the sit-ins that made them different than something like the Montgomery bus boycott, which was during the boycott, people tried to avoid getting arrested. The point of the boycott was sort of to withdraw from segregation. But what the sit-ins did was confront segregation, get in its face. The whole point of sitting in was to be arrested, was to show the immorality of segregation by getting arrested. And that this confrontation was a real change from the kind of protest that had happened before and was designed to really starkly show the American public how awful segregation was. So in that way, it was actually a lot more in this tradition of a kind of Gandhian nonviolence in its confrontation with evil than what King had been doing with the boycott, which was sort of challenging it by withdrawing. And there was a huge difference and a huge excitement and charge that people got by breaking the law, breaking this immoral law that they had been forced to obey for so long. People got a real charge about participating in a sit-in that was different than a kind of boycott, which felt in some ways more passive to participants. To not do something is more passive than to, break the law.
You're not critical, though, are you, of that tactic? I thought that was an extraordinary event, the Montgomery bus boycott, where African-Americans, led by soon to be a Detroiter, Rosa Parks, whole community moved in it together to say, if we can't have our humanity, we'll walk.
That's exactly right. And I don't mean to be critical of the boycott so much as I would say that one of the problems of the boycott was, even as it pulled the community together, it was hard to reproduce the boycott over and over again. And the sit-ins, as a simple tactic, were easy to reproduce over and over again. And in that way, they built on and extended the boycott and turned the civil rights movement into an even more of a mass movement. So I see it more as a kind of extension of the boycott, of building on it, rather than an either-or choice.
Well, let's do this. First, let me reintroduce you. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Andrew B. Lewis. He's written The Shadows of Youth, A Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation. And by now, hopefully, this is all coming back to you. If this is still foggy history, do yourself a favor and look it up, because it's an extraordinary, important, and exciting period in American history. And let's go to the Shadows of Youth. Tell me about the title, the Shadows of Youth. What are the shadows here? I was going to guess, but I'll let you declare.
Well, I thought of the title in three ways. One, that youth shadowed the civil rights movement in that it was young people at the forefront of it and who took charge of it. I also thought of the title in the ways in which the youth of the participants shadowed the rest of their lives. And one of the questions I had been interested in was, if you helped change the world before you were 30, what would the rest of your life feel like? And in many ways, people were shadowed by their youth. And thirdly, I thought of the title in the ways in which this is the moment in which the idea of youth really begins to shadow the American experience, and we become an even more youth-obsessed society, and we think of youth as a great concept. And so I thought of the title in all those different ways.
With the photograph, here are these very young people staring into the camera, and they're in a triangular shape. And Julian Bond, who you've co-authored a book with, maybe use him as a sort of exemplary of the path that one of your subjects in Shadows of Youth followed, from his origins. And we could probably spend about an hour talking about Julian Bond, but maybe a brief look at his life.
Yeah, I think he's a great example. His father was a college administrator, and he grew up outside of Philadelphia and also in Atlanta. He went to college at Morehouse and wasn't that involved in activism up to that point. And one of the things that's interesting about his life and the life of, say, Diane Nash from Chicago or Ivanhoe Donaldson from Detroit or many of the others is that after World War II, the African-American middle class expanded. It was still far behind the white middle class, but in absolute terms, it had grown much larger, and there were many more African-Americans going to college. And in many ways, they felt part of the youth culture of the 50s. They wore Levi's. They listened to Elvis as well as Chuck Berry. And yet, their race set them apart. And so there were many kind of confusing messages being given. And in the picture you refer to, you can see Julian is dressed like an ordinary, preppy 1950s teenager. And then the movement happens, and he becomes deeply involved in activism and spends his 20s working for SNCC and with SNCC, helping bring about change in the South. And in 1968, he becomes the youngest person to have his name placed in nomination for the vice presidency and becomes all of a sudden the most famous black man in America. And for a few years, he is one of the leading fundraisers for the Democratic Party. But his political career fizzles out in part because there's not that many avenues in the South for African Americans to hold elective office. And he has a period where he's not sure what he wants to do with his life. And then in the 90s, he becomes chairman of the NAACP and helps revive that organization. And so one of the things about Julian that I think is great and exemplary of the story of many people in SNCC is that arc from sort of baby boomer to activist to community leader to a sort of establishment figure is embodied by many of the people in the book.
Now, he actually is, in some broad sense, a sort of a Barack Obama figure 30 years before.
That's right. That's right. And I always like to think that for a while, up until he got the nomination, one of the few people in America who could understand what it was like to be Barack Obama was Julian Bond, who had a career path very similar to him. He was elected to the state Senate. He made his name at a convention. He was an electrifying speaker. The difference, of course, was that in Illinois, there was a route for Obama now to get elected to the Senate and move his career forward. For Bond, in Georgia, there was no opportunity to move forward, and so his political career stalled. But for a while, his path was like Obama's from 2004 until 2007. Their lives were similar in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Lewis, you co-authored with Julian Bond, Gonna Sit at the Welcome Table, a documentary history of the civil rights movement. How did you guys are from different generations. You're from a younger generation. How did you hook up with him?
I was a grad student at the University of Virginia when Julian started teaching classes there, and we actually got to know each other. Funny enough, I went to Cal Ripken in 1996, when Ripken was breaking the record. Julian's wife is a huge baseball fan. Julian himself isn't. And they didn't have a TV in their apartment in Charlottesville, and I invited them over to watch the game. I ended up spending most of the night talking to Julian, and we became friendly after that. And in many ways, he inspired this book because he told me some really interesting stories about the kind of day-to-day life of the movement. And one of the things that I got out of those stories, which I've tried to do in the book, is that the civil rights movement, especially for the young people in SNCC, was one of the great adventure stories of the late 20th century. And that in addition to being scary and politically important, it was also completely exciting, great fun, and a great adventure in the sense that it was young people living low to the ground, on the road, hanging out together. There was a part of the story of the movement that I thought hadn't been told, which was that there was an element of fun mixed into the seriousness. And I think we often, our story is mostly about how serious it is, and then the activists become kind of as boring and dour as the Puritans, when in fact this was a completely exciting moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody in the photograph on the cover of your book, The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, has a very serious look on their face. And I wonder, Andrew Lewis, if you could talk to us about white people, Euro-Americans, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, because right in back of Julian Bond, and I'm asking about too many questions at once. It's posed triangularly with Julian Bond at the center of it, and then right behind them are a white man and a white woman. Tell us some about how whites figured in SNCC, what their motivation was. If you know anything about the positioning of this people in this photograph, there's a lot of things there. So, but
that's a great question. The person in the photograph you're talking to is the first white person to join SNCC. His name was Bob Zellner. He was from Alabama, and his grandfather and father were both Klansmen, actually. And he went to college in Montgomery, Alabama, and he wanted to write a paper. He was in college in 1956 and when the boycott was going on, and he wanted to write a paper about it, and his teachers at college sent him only to the White Citizens Council and other segregationist groups for information, and he wanted to interview King, and they told him he couldn't, and this got him interested in the movement, and a few years later he joined SNCC becoming one of its most celebrated leaders. But in a broader sense, the SNCC inspired almost all of the what we call the New Left, the student movements of the 60s. And a perfect example of that is Tom Hayden, who was at the University of Michigan, who was the editor of the student paper, who was so excited about what the students were doing that he drove down south, participated in some of the protests, and sent back glowing articles to the Michigan newspaper about what was going on.
Also managed to get beaten pretty badly. There's a famous pamphlet that Tom Hayden wrote with him sitting nonviolently on the ground and some big bruiser slamming his fist into the side of his head.
That's right. That's in Macomb, Mississippi, when he went down to observe the protests and to participate and to meet the students. And Hayden is one of the bridges between SNCC and the anti-war movement and the New Left, the white New Left. And in many ways, SNCC inspired a generation of white college students to think about the ways in which they could protest and the ideals that they should be working for. So white students were both members of SNCC and, in a broader sense, inspired by it. They were, in many ways, the early members of SNCC were kind of like rock stars in the early to mid-1960s to a generation of activist college students and inspired by them.
Now, there was a number of huge personalities, people that in the period of the 60s were almost household names, and some of them came to a bad end, like H. Rapp Brown and to some extent Stokely Carmichael, depending on how you read that. Others, like John Lewis, went into Congress, Julian Bond, the head of the NAACP. Oh, I forgot Marion Barry, who certainly a checkered career. What any sense why... particularly, though, let's go for the ones that definitely came to some bad ends. H. Rapp Brown, who's serving a life sentence for killing a police officer, and Marion Barry, who's had incredible scrapes with the law. Why these people that were, there must have been some transformation there, that they were indignant about what was happening to African-American people, yet then somehow, got corrupted, or how would you read it?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple ways to read it. One thing that I think is interesting about the story is that the lives people led as they got older are as varied as the people themselves. But in the cases you're talking about, I think one of the things that we often forget is the personal cost of activism, which is to be an activist in the South during the early 1960s was, as I said, an adventure, but a scary adventure in which you were often fearful for your life, and that for many people that took a deep psychological toll. And I think many of the SNCC activists suffered from a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder in the ways in which they were fighting a kind of domestic war, and the toll for some was heavier than others. And I would also say for Stokely Carmichael and for Marion Barry to some extent is that the skills that can make you a really good activist sometimes aren't always the skills that make you a really good politician or are really suited for other kinds of work. And so some people had a harder time making the transition to middle age than others. And so the fearlessness, the recklessness, the willingness to confront danger that can make you an amazing activist are not always the best skills for a middle-aged person trying to sort of eke out a career and do some other things. And so for them, it was hard to make the transition in some ways.
Let's, and I can't believe how fast this interview is going, and because, you know, trying to sum up a whole period in American history, that's why Andrew Lewis has written The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation, published by Helen Wang. And at the end of SNCC's existence, I can't remember who said it, but he said that, that something they should change their name because they're not students, they're not nonviolent, they don't coordinate anything, and they're not a committee. And at one point, whites were expelled. And my history isn't strong enough to remember exactly either what caused that or what year that was.
Yeah, it happened in 1966, and for example, Bob Zellner, who was one of SNCC's most celebrated members, was thrown out, and he actually came back again to see if he could reaffiliate with SNCC. And it came out in part because, even as I talk about the Civil Rights Generation, one thing that was true about the early activists of SNCC is how fast they burned out. The years from 1960 to 1966 felt like a lifetime. And I think one thing to remember about this and about the kind of frustration that led to expelling whites was we often think of that as an internal change, which is that activists became more black nationalistic or that they became more exclusive. In many ways, the change was external, which is they were disappointed in the failure of the federal government to live up to the promises of the Voting Rights Act, to live up to the promises of the Civil Rights Act, and that they were seeking new tactics, new ways to address that. And that one of the things they thought about was that they needed black political power, not because they were nationalistic, but because whites weren't willing to work in coalitions, that the federal government wasn't doing what it should to protect, even after the Voting Rights Act, protect black voters, to help people register to vote. So in many ways, the change was a kind of change of external frustration rather than an internal change of ideology, even though we often see it that way. And one of the things I tried to get across in my book is how disappointed we should be in the federal government's weak response to the civil rights activists, not just early on, but throughout the 1960s. The federal government did the minimum possible all the time to help the activists, and their role should be criticized more than it should be celebrated.
The book is The Shadows of Youth, The Remarkable Journey of the Civil Rights Generation. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show has been Andrew B. Lewis, the author. The Publishers Weekly says, with deep admiration and rigorous scholarship, historian Lewis reveals the ragtag band of young men and women who formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. With this eloquent book, he offers a deserved tribute. Well worth picking up and getting another aspect of American history into our brains. I've neglected to ask you before, is there a website dedicated to this book, or should we send them to Helen Wang, which is fsgbooks.com?
Yeah, there is there's a page dedicated to the book at redroom.com, which is our site for writers. And if you look under Andrew Lewis or Shadows of Youth, there's a page dedicated to the book with a blog about some upcoming events and other things, places for people to write comments and things like that.
Also, I'll put a link on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com, and you can link from there as well. Andrew Lewis, been great. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
775-608-8877. Not available in all states. That's Debt Settlement USA. 1-877-560-8877. 1-877-560-8877.
Over there's the water. Whoosh, whoosh. And look at all this stuff I'm standing on. It's called sand, and it's everywhere.
This woman may sound silly to you and me.
It's made up of little tiny pieces of rocks. Teeny little pieces of rocks.
But to her 2-year-old son exploring the world around him, she makes perfect sense.
How does it feel when you touch the sand? Is it warm?
Uh-huh.
It's hard to hold in your hand, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Learning starts long before school does, and children are naturally curious. They want to learn, so follow their lead. Take simple, everyday moments, like sorting laundry or playing on the beach, and turn them into learning moments.
Is this water?
No.
Very good. This is sand. Oh, no, it's not food. It's sand. We don't eat sand.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. Find out how at pornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
We've been in business 10 years and have really built something.
And we want to keep it.
Tornado, cyber attack, anything can happen.
So we went to ready.gov and found free templates and checklists to help put an emergency preparedness plan together. So now we worry less about the unforeseen.
And worry about the foreseen.
Payroll, our customers.
Remember when your hair wasn't gray?
Remember when you had hair?
Hey.
Go to ready.gov for details on creating an emergency preparedness plan. Becoming a success is hard work. Protecting it isn't. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the Ad Council, and the station.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As you know, I frequently have friends of mine on the show, people that have taken a lifetime to look at different aspects of our society. Rarely, though, do I get to interview somebody who has had such an impact on me over the years. And I speak this time of Frances Moore LePay. Her books, Diet for a Small Planet, had an extreme impact on the kind of food I've eaten all for the rest of my life since they were written and published in the early 1970s. But Frances Moore LePay has done much more beyond her books, although they've sold in the millions, been translated into 20 languages. She co-founded the Institute for Food and Development Policy, Food First, and that's in its 32nd year. The American News Service, which operated from 1995 to 2000, and Frances Moore LePay has appeared on The Today Show, PBS Now, All Things Considered, and The Diane Rehm Show, and her articles have appeared in Harper's, The Oprah Magazine, The New York Times, The Los Angeles Times, People Magazine, and so many more that I think I would spend too much time introducing her. Frances Moore LePay, thank you for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
What a great delight for me, Peter.
Well, it was just wonderful when I saw your book, Diet for a Small Planet, and I read it. And I remember distinctly that night when we were having liver and onions for dinner, and I had this huge calf's liver in my hands, washing it off under the sink, under the tap, and I said, "This is it. That's it for meat and me." So I want to thank you for that. It had an extreme impact on my life. But before we get into your brand new book, Getting a Grip: Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad, can you draw us kind of a line from that book, from the books about diet, to a book about our whole world, Getting a Grip?
Well, I had to figure out why hunger in a world of plenty. And that set me on quite a journey. And pretty soon I figured out that hunger is not caused by scarcity of food, but a scarcity of democracy is the way that I summed it up. But I meant by that there's plenty of food in the world, in fact, enough to make each of us chubby, and there still is. What hunger is caused by is a lack of democracy. What I mean by that is the denial of people's voice so that they can express their interest. And, of course, our first interest is in eating and feeding our offspring. So that really is how I got to where I am today in writing this book, Getting a Grip.
Do you think others saw that linear progression as well, or did they, like, beginning with Diet for a Small Planet, which is an analysis of the food we eat, but is also just terrific recipes and a book still in print? And there's a follow-up.
Yes, I wrote with my daughter a sequel called Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet, and that was really the mountaintop experience of my life traveling the world with my daughter, who was exactly the age that I was when I wrote my first book. So I've been on this journey for a while, and Getting a Grip is really the distillation of what I, in my attempt to get a grip and to share that with others, that really believing that most people recognize that the planet is in big trouble, and we've got to be able to identify what are the underlying causes of the suffering and the devastation of nature and our lives, our daily lives, through the great stress that we're under. Now, how do we analyze root causes so that we can feel that we're actually reversing those toward health? Otherwise, we feel that our acts are just kind of, you know, grasping at straws, or sometimes I call it random acts of sanity, that, you know, it might feel good at the moment, but we don't really see how it adds up to anything. And so this is a book about how does it add up to something, because we can really see the root causes and pinpoint them and reverse the negative.
Well, I think everyone, as a matter of course, maybe it's even rooted in our sociobiology, we're addicted to the now, to what we find in front of us, generally trying to make the best of it. I know there's a lot of people that try to make the worst of it for themselves and others, but most of us try to make the best of it. But when people are trying to break addiction, one of the problems always is a denial of the person that's having the addiction. And I was noticing in your subtitle of Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. I don't know that everyone would share your view. I do, that the world has gone mad. But is that do you think that's a problem, that we don't recognize the state we're in?
I do, in a way. I mean, I think that the epidemic of depression is one symptom of what you're talking about, because I think when we're denying what we know, it is depressing. And I think many of the diseases that we are encountering, the expansion of today, relate to that depression. And so I think that when people feel powerless, it maybe can feel better to stay in denial, because if you really faced up to what's going on, then you'd know that you couldn't do anything. So my response to that is, wait a minute, we're not powerless. We don't have to remain in depression. We don't have to deny the best of ourselves. And that, look, here is what we are doing, those of us who are breaking out of that depression and just sense of despair. So I think that can be contagious too. That I do agree with you. There's a lot of denial. But as we see our neighbors sort of stepping out and taking risks and becoming more alive, then that will give a lot of those of us in denial the courage to do the same.
Well, in your book, it's wonderfully, besides what the words in it, it's also wonderfully laid out, a wonderful design. And in the front cover and in the back cover, the inside covers, you have the spiral of powerlessness and the spiral of empowerment.
Yes.
I don't know if you have the book in front of you or you can do this.
Yes, I could do it in my sleep.
Okay, tell us the spiral of powerlessness, because that's what leads to so many of the maladies of this world, maybe all of them.
Well, honestly, I think that we've bought this line that human beings can be reduced to this caricature, that we're nothing but, you know, you can peel away the fluff around the edges, and then we're nothing but these grubby little materialists, you know, out to get more stuff, competitive and material and looking out for number one. And with that kind of dim view of ourselves, then we come to believe that, of course, we're incapable of coming together and creating a society that works for all of us and getting money out of politics and really stepping up and deliberating over what's good for the whole country, the whole world. And we then give over our fate to others. We give over our fate to this impersonal law that John D. Rockefeller called it, the law of God and of nature. Ronald Reagan called it the magic of the market, this idea that there's some, you know, magical force out there called the market that's going to just decide outcomes, and then we are really stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we end up the what I call the one rule economy, the highest return to existing wealth, that is the shareholders, that's the one rule. So wealth inexorably concentrates, then it infects the political system. 61 lobbyists now in Washington for every person that you and I voted to represent us. And so then you have, yes, you have billions of dollars in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry that's polluting and you know, heating our planet. And then you start seeing the affirmation of your assumption that you started with, which is that all we are these grubby, you know, materialists out to get ours. And so it's a spiral. It's a vicious circle that then we start going downhill, and then people give up, and they say, oh, yeah, people are just, you know, this narrow, shabby caricature. So it is really time to say, wait a minute, we can stop debating whether human beings are good or bad. Clearly, we can be both. And so what my book is all about is saying, we can even now know because of neuroscience experiments that there are these, we don't have to debate that human beings are good of their nature, but we can certainly say that there is enough goodness in us that we can tap. And I love the experiments now showing these hardwired needs for fairness, for cooperation, for power, for efficacy in the world. So these are things that we all have in us if our society will call on that. And how, my question is then, how do we move from this dangerous thin democracy that is concentrating power and move to a living democracy in which people are creating new power through their own engagement? And it's happening, Peter. This is not my, you know, fantasy dream. This is real.
Well, let's examine that a little, because although my Tai Chi teacher would hate me for this formulation, she wouldn't hate me, she would hate the formulation, to say, I usually think there's like two-thirds good people in the world and one-third bad. That's the formulation she would, you know, shake her head at and what have you. But and that third has a grip on that concentrated power, that concentrated wealth, that that often uses it for malign purposes. And yet they are so powerful. And it seems like they don't sleep, where most of us, as you said, want to provide for our families. We want an exciting and interesting life. And we're not interested in, and you maybe should speak about this word, we're not interested in power, certainly not power over. We want the power to have a decent life and what have you. But this other third is interested in power over, and throughout history has barely been hurtful to the majority of people on the planet and the planet itself.
Well, that's a really interesting way of looking at it, and it's but I mean, even say taking your formulation just as it is, the real question, we can't blame, say, I won't argue with your math, right? We'll just say okay. This third, right? Okay, we can't really blame them if the majority, the two-thirds, are letting it happen. And we're letting it happen because I argue, and there's a chapter in Getting a Grip about fear. And I argue that we're letting things happen that violate our deepest common sense and our deepest values and just hearts, because we're afraid of conflict. We're afraid of being different because we evolved in community, in tribes, in which separating from the pack was really dangerous. It could mean death. And we're so social. This is the best in us that we want to be liked. And so we don't want to be critical or stand out from the crowd. We want to fit in. And I'm saying now the stakes are too high, that you and I, all of us, have to learn that we can walk with our fear of difference, and actually it's exhilarating. It's, yes, you know, it is scary to speak up and to step out of your comfort zone and be involved in things that matter to you, but it's also exhilarating, and it gets us out of our depression, and it gets us into friendships with people. You know how they always say, well, people who go to war together, you know, one of the only positive things you could say about battle is that it creates these bonds, I mean, this is what I read anyway, mm-hmm. among people who are fighting. Well, the kind of bonds that get created among people who are working for a common purpose to make their communities better is so rewarding. So I think that we can't focus on the them, even if I did agree with you, because really it's up to all of us who don't want power over, but want to manifest power over other people, you know, negative power over other people, but just want power to create a world that works for our families, our neighborhoods, for other people, as well as ourselves. That takes some courage, and that's why courage is the last section of my book. And I tell the stories of people who have found that in themselves, that they can walk with their fear of difference and find it, that their lives are just transformed for the better.
The book is Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. The author is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, Frances Moore LePay. You can go to gettingagrip.org, and also I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. And give us some examples.
Well, let me just give you an example of somebody who I think, you know, I talked about the spiral, and how do you just break it and start reversing it into the spiral of empowerment. One of my heroes in the book is Marge Mead, a grandma in Arizona who kind of stumbled into, well, she moved into a new city in Arizona, and she didn't know people, so she went to a League of Women Voters meeting, and their secretary was missing or something. Anyway, she got called in to take minutes. She decided they needed minutes and they weren't even taking them, and she knew shorthand, so she started taking minutes. She was so intimidated by what she was hearing, because it was all about a new law to get money out of politics in Arizona and to make clean elections where there's no significant private money involved at all. And she got fascinated by this, and she was so fascinated that she said, I became reincarnated as a political activist. But she went to church basements and rotary clubs, and she talked about this legislation and became one of the state's experts. And then this law passed, and now she is seeing it working. Now, in two states, Maine and Arizona, where Marge lives, money is virtually out of the system. 80% of those who run for office run without private money, in other words, without corporate backing. So they have, after they're elected, they answer to the citizens rather than to some private interests. And so my son, a filmmaker, Anthony LePay, has just made a short film that's going to be on that website that you just mentioned, gettingagrip.org. And it is a film about another hero of mine in Maine, who was a waitress, high school educated, and decided she could run for office and has made a huge contribution after she won. So these are the stories about people who walked with their fear. I mean, Marge had no idea what she was getting into. And Deb in Maine, you know, when her friend said, you should run for office, she said, you're crazy. And then she said, wait a minute, I could do that. All I have to do is raise $5 from 50 people, because they had clean elections. And we could do that in every state, and we could do it at a national level.
I think it's so important to emphasize the positive, and as saying that, I'm going to go back a little to the negative, and maybe, but you speak about that in your book, Getting a Grip, fear. I mean, because although certainly people do not like to be different or don't want to seem troublemaker or radicals, even though, hey, troublemakers and radicals founded this country, right?
Right. That's what people forget.
Yeah.
Yes.
That fears also have to do with how the whole population, including us. I mean, we're not safe from it. The kind of manipulation of fears that come through the mass media, that in fact that are sometimes are rooted in real events like 9/11, that get people have a tendency to walk in lockstep. Tell me about the process of overcoming fear.
Well, before I do, if you'll forgive me, I'd like to just make the point that, yes, there's fear is the emotional plague of our planet. I agree. But actually, if we are living our lives from the point of fear, I'm convinced that we end up creating what we most fear. And I learned that first with food. I learned our fear of scarcity actually ends up reducing the capacity of the earth to feed us. that we are wasting such enormous amounts of food in the world. 70% of agricultural land is growing livestock, and in this country we feed most of what grows in the United States, we feed to animals, and if the beef cow that we're feeding, it returns only 1 pound in meat to us for every 16 pounds we feed. So what we, and look at the whole situation after 9/11, we fear terrorism, but what are we doing? I mean, what are we doing in this war on Iraq? We are actually giving reason for people to be more bitter, more angry, more righteously wanting to stand up against us, in fact, kill themselves in order to kill some of us. So we are actually generating what we fear. And if we come from that point, we will continue to do that. And so we have to learn not to be so afraid of fear. And what I mean by that is it took me a long time to get it, and I guess we don't have time in this radio interview to tell you the story, but in any case, I learned from a great teacher in Africa that fear is simply energy. It's not a verdict. When we feel that pounding heart, when we, you know, feel the cold sweat from fear, that's just information. And it could be that it's not telling us that we're in the wrong place, that we should fight or flee or freeze. It might be telling us that we are right at our growth edge and we should just keep walking. And over and over again, I keep learning this. And when I feel in a group that I'm out of step, now when I experience that pounding heart of feeling different, I've renamed it Inner Applause.
I like that.
And it works. And it tells me, rather than saying, oh, you're a wimp, why are you freaking out, you're a wimp, it says to me, oh, you are right on your edge, go for it. And it really has changed my whole sense of myself. I lived with a lot of fear a few years ago, and that gave me a whole new understanding when I really worked through it and realized it did not stop me, and it never will have to stop me.
At the beginning of the program, Frances Moore LePay, I had you read from the what do you call those first pages? There's a word for it. The inside where you have the spiral of powerlessness. That's called the inside front cover.
Right.
We have
the
spiral of powerlessness. And on the back cover, though, it has the spiral of empowerment. I wonder if you could go through those before our time runs out, because that overcomes that spiral of powerlessness.
Absolutely. I mean, it starts with this idea that it's not whether human nature is good, you know, the goodness of human nature, but the goodness in human nature. It's simply recognizing what is obvious to all of us, that we get pleasure from cooperation. Do you know that MRI studies of the brain show that when we're cooperating, that parts of our brains light up, that are the same parts that light up when we eat chocolate?
I love it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you know, even you know, animals in the animal kingdom surely were as sensitive and compassionate as rhesus monkeys, who will go for 12 days without eating if it means that they can avoid hurting their fellow monkey. I mean, it's amazing the evidence that's now mounting about, you know, just our need for fairness in community. I mean, it's definitely hardwired in us, because we couldn't survive in communities. We understood that if things were unfair. So I'm saying, let's start with that base, and then from that we recognize that we can deliberate over how to use the tools of government and the economic tools of the market rather than being its victim. And we realize that government and the market economy are not enemies in competition, that it takes a democratic society, a democratic government, to make the market work. Otherwise, it turns into monopolies that we're seeing today, where there's just a few companies that control virtually every major industry. So it requires an open market where people can enter, where new parties can enter, and where everyone can participate. It requires a democratic government, and then we can start solving our problems, and that reinforces this belief in the best in us. And so there's a virtuous cycle that operates once we walk with our fear and step up and speak out and gain the sense of power by listening to the best in us. And so that is my call in this book, that we know now what is necessary for society to bring out the best in us. And it starts with the widest dispersion of power, and the only way that's going to happen is as you and I step up and discover that power isn't something that somebody else has, that evil thing, that corrupt thing. It's what we could create together. Because power, when it goes back to its root in Latin, the meaning of power is simply to be able, the capacity to act. And so as my book is full of examples of people who've never been involved before in anything outside of their own workplace or family, who are stepping up and just finding it exhilarating to make a difference, like Marge and Deb, for example, in Maine, who, you know, who would have thought a waitress would now be co-chair of the Judiciary Committee in Maine.
Well, you have this hopefulness, which is really inspiring, because, as you said earlier, there's a general epidemic of depression. And among peace and social justice activists, there is this feeling of many people I speak to, of burnout, of, you know, no matter how many people we mobilize, the government keeps doing what it's doing. With things that have to be addressed aren't. But even one of your books you mentioned earlier, Hope's Edge, I mean, we could be on this cusp, eh? I mean,
yes. I mean, I think, by the way, I don't really consider myself an optimist. I consider myself a possibilist, meaning that I think it is possible that people are really waking up now that they see the consequences of the path that we're on, and now that human species has the history and we have the capacity to look back and to see where this path has taken us and what the conditions are that bring out the worst in us. And so it's really the piece that is, that we really have to work with then, is our own sense of capacity. That's the walking with our fears that maybe we can't make this turn, or walking with our fear of being different. And that's why I include all these stories of people who are finding their lives so enriched by actually moving into their discomfort zone and finding new parts of themselves as they discover they are not powerless. In fact, you know, one of the points I make in the book throughout is that we all are creating the world moment to moment. So we have no choice as to not be world changers. We're all world changers. Even if we're doing nothing but going to work and coming home and sitting in front of the television, we are changing the world. We are reinforcing the spiral of powerlessness. So we are changing it in the direction of, I would say, death, to use a pretty inflammatory word, but that's my view. And so as we wake up and realize, no, we can speak out, then we are changing it in another way. But either way, we are changing it. And each of the choices we make, our purchases, for example, or where we put our retirement funds, all of those are sending out enormous ripples, saying, for example, if we buy food that is drenched with pesticides in its production, we're saying to the world, oh, yeah, I want more of that. I want more of those chemicals that are polluting our rivers and waterways and harming our farm workers and farmers and even our own bodies. So, you know, we have power.
And we have the choice of the spiral of empowerment that Frances Moore LePay writes about so eloquently in her brand new book, Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. You can go to gettingagrip.org for more information. It's published by Small Planet Media. That's at smallplanetmedia.org. These links will be on my site, peterwerby.com. The Washington Post says some of the 20th century's most vibrant activist thinkers have been American women. Margaret Mead, Jeanette Rankin, Barbara Ward, Dorothy Day, who took it upon themselves to pump life into basic truths. Frances Moore LePay is among them. It's been a pleasure to have you on my program. Thank you so much.
No, it's been my pleasure, Peter. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Did I win?
I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your walk right in free station. 101.
Who are you?
WRIF.
Sometimes it's hard.
hard to make good decisions. We want to have fun and fit in, but we don't want to disappoint our families, our friends, or ourselves. There's a lot we're not sure about. But here's something you can believe. Real friends like you for who you are, so you don't need to drink to fit in. For more information, visit our website, thecoolspot.gov. Check it out. Brought to you by the Department of Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, and the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism.
Go red any way you want. Eat red apples, cherries, tomatoes. Ride a red bicycle. Leave red kisses on someone's cheek. Wear a red scarf. Laugh so hard your face turns red. But whatever you do, do it for your heart. Go red from the inside out. Take a moment every day and put your hand on your heart. Make a promise to yourself to be heart healthy, to eat well, to exercise, to know your personal risk factors. The American Heart Association wants you to make red the color of an active life. Take a moment and go red in your own fashion. Go red for women. Love your heart. Go red today. Visit goredforwomen.org or call 1-888-MY-HEART.
You must be your fairy godmother.
Yes. It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number. And get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Energy Hog the team. I want you to infiltrate the house and waste some energy.
Just sneak into these leaky windows.
It's just like we thought, boss. No insulation in the attic.
Perfect. Now go wild and waste some wattage.
The Mitchell House. A house like many others. Except this one's under attack by energy hogs. They show up anywhere energy is being wasted.
Talk to me, hogs.
The washer. It's my energy star rating.
Outstanding. What about the thermostat?
Not programmable. I repeat, not programmable.
Looks like we're living high on the hog.
Only one person has the power to get rid of energy hogs. You.
Hold on! Someone's home!
Andy's got energy-efficient light bulbs!
To find out how you can fight energy hogs, log on to energyhog.org. You'll find fun games and lots of tips on making your home more energy efficient.
Now he's installing Energy Star appliances.
Not Energy Star! That's it! Get out of there! I'll get you, energyhog.org!
Hey! Wait for me!
Brought to you by the Alliance to Save Energy, the Department of Energy, and the Ad Council.
Thanksgiving Throwdown with Rob Zombie. Friday, November 27th at the Fillmore Detroit.
Get all the details at WRIF.com.
101 WRIF. The Riff.
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run. Try to hide. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here. Dug our treasures there. But that can still recall the time we cried. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
rock and roll.
Everything that rocks.
Rock has an exciting life of its own.
Famous 101 WRIF.
WRIF HD1 Detroit.
And WRIF.com.
Perfectly balanced. Low drag. Minimal torque.
The Riff.